You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I'm currently on a book tour around the United States and hope to see you. Find the schedule of my events at warisalie.org. It is my privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week two guests simultaneously. One is Jean Trounstein. She is the author of a powerful new book. It is called Boy with a Knife, a story of murder, remorse, and a prisoner's fight for justice. The epilogue is by Carter Reed, who is also the primary subject of the book. And I'd love to welcome Jean Trounstein and Carter Reed to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You as well. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thank you both for being on here. Jean, why don't we start with you? What is the basic topic and purpose of this book, Boy with a Knife?
I began the book really after I got a letter from Carter, which invited me to give him some help. I had done work in prison. I had written a book about prison. He found my book in the prison library and wrote for help. I didn't know much about juvenile justice, and because of ultimately our correspondence, it stimulated me to do a lot of research and interviewing, and I saw how awful it was to try send juveniles to adult facilities. At this point in time, there are 200,000 such kids who are in the system. It was 250,000 at the time I started the book. But there are so many things that happen to these kids that are because they're put with adults. So I got very interested in the subject, and that's really what I aim to do, is show that a child, no matter how heinous the crime, is capable of change. And Carter is the example of that person.
So he wrote to you as a child from an adult prison?
No, he wrote to me as a child. Well, yes, excuse me, from an adult prison. He wasn't a child. He was 31 at the time. He had spent 15 years behind bars.
At the time that he first wrote to you?
Yeah.
Yeah. And Carter, how old were you back in 1993?
I was 16 years old.
You were 16, and you were living with your own father was in prison, and you carried a knife around for protection. Tell us what happened. This was in Massachusetts in 1993, right?
Yes, in 1993. At that time, I lived with my mom and my two sisters, and I was probably pretty much like your average 16-year-old kid. I was kind of small and a little bit shy and insecure, and I lived in a kind of, rough neighborhood, not anything particular, but, I was a kid who was at that age where I wanted to be looked up to and respected by my peers, and I wanted to fit in, and, I carried a knife and had this idea of masculinity and manhood and what it meant to be a man. And for me in particular, because I was kind of a little shy and insecure, it was something that I tried to have this, at least in my head, this kind of persona of somebody who was willing to stand up for himself and his friends. And so a friend of mine, my best friend since childhood and a mutual friend of ours, came to me one day for help. I guess there had been an ongoing kind of feud between them and another group of kids. And over the course of the weekend, this kind of feud escalated, and it reached the point where that Monday morning following the weekend, they were concerned that something was going to happen at the school that they went to, which was not the same school that I went to. And like I said, these are my friends. And of course, trying to be this, macho this macho 16-year-old in front of his friends, you know, when they called me and said, hey, we think something might happen at school. We think these kids are going to, you know, try to retaliate against us in some way. We want you to come with us. You know, I had this whole gung-ho attitude, at least outwardly, you know, this facade of, you know, yeah, come get me. I got your back. And, you know, whatever happens, you know, I'm there for you. And so my two friends, Gator and Nigel, they came and picked me up, and we went to Thomas High, at least initially anticipating that maybe something would happen. And, of course, like I said, it, you know, on the outside I had this very macho front about, you know, how I had their backs and I was ready to stand up for whatever happened. And on the inside I was, of course, hoping desperately that nothing happened. And when we got to the school and we walked in, it seemed like nothing would happen. It appeared that we had overreacted and anticipated something that wasn't going to happen. And I was very relieved that nothing happened. No one was really looking for us. The kind of rumors that died down in the course of that, the day that it transpired. And so I kind of stood there hanging out with some my friends and some kids that I was acquainted with from the town. And I basically was bragging about how lucky this other group of kids was that, you know, they didn't try anything that morning. And within a few minutes, we saw this group of kids basically come charging toward us. And they didn't see me. They saw Nigel first, who was the kid who had initially been involved in this, you know, this kind of ongoing thing with this other group of kids, and they passed right by me, and I was, you know, I was scared. I was completely frozen. I didn't move, and I just watched them go right past me toward Nigel. One of the kids in the front of the group said something to Nigel, and then began throwing punches, and then eventually this group kind of surrounded him. You know, Nigel hit the floor, and they were, you know, punching and kicking him. I was in, you know, school hallway, so immediately teachers came out to break it up, and the kids that had attacked Nigel ran one way, and Gator managed to grab Nigel, and the three of us got out of the school going in the other direction. And so we immediately drove to a friend's house down the street who was an older kid that we hung around with, who had a reputation for being tough. And I mean, we had this idea that if we could get him to come back with us, you know, the same thing wouldn't happen this time. You know, maybe things would turn out in our favor. And he was unable to come back with us. He encouraged us to, you know, wait until after school and see what would happen, you know, later on in the day. And in our minds, we thought, you know, the reason that things had reached the point that they had was because we had allowed them to, you know, to drag on over the course of the weekend into Monday, and that the best solution was to try to resolve it immediately. Even though, you know, by this time, you know, school was in session, we thought we needed to do something right then and there to really, you know, make a stand for ourselves. And so we decided to go back to Dartmouth High, and we headed back to the school. And when we pulled up in front of the school, Gator grabbed a baseball bat from out of the car, and Nigel grabbed the billy club. And the three of us headed in to the school. We had this idea in our heads that, you know, we were just going to go in and kind of do the same thing to them that they did to Nigel, and that would be the end of it. It was obviously not well thought out, and in the heat of the moment, somehow we imagined that maybe this was a good idea, or at the very least, that it was necessary. And so we headed into the school, and we headed up to Nigel's first period class, where we expected to find a couple of the kids that were involved in the earlier fight. And I think finally at that moment when we got outside this room, you know, we all kind of just stopped and, you know, looked at each other and kind of like looking to each other to figure out what we were going to do, because it just, you know, now it seems kind of absurd that we were in this position. And, you know, we talked about it for maybe 30 seconds or so, and we kind of all agreed that this was, you know, a foolish plan, and we were going to abandon it. And we started to walk out of the school, at which point we noticed a couple of teachers heading down the hall toward us. So we turned to walk in the other direction, away from them. There were teachers coming from that end of the hall as well. What we obviously didn't know at that point was that these teachers had seen us. Someone had seen us come in the front door of the school. They had seen Gator with the baseball bat, and it sent teachers, you know, throughout the school looking for us. And so at that point, Gator, who again was, you know, my friend since I was about 5 years old, turned and said, you know, what do you want to do? And I said, you know, I don't know, but I'm not going to leave you here if you go in. I said, I got your back no matter what. And so he turned and ran into the classroom. And I kind of, at the moment he turned and ran in, you know, the teachers who were in the hall obviously, you know, bolted toward us. And in my mind, in that moment when I saw them heading toward us, I thought, you know, this is over. This is my out. And I'm just going to kind of surrender myself to them. And, you know, here I have a perfect excuse for why I didn't do anything. And, you know, I can tell the story about how I would have done something had, you know, these teachers not taken me into custody. And in the meantime, you know, this couple of seconds this is all transpiring, Gator gets to the front of the room and he's staring at an empty seat where one of the kids that we were looking for was supposed to be sitting. And he kind of starts to panic. He's looking back and forth to me and to the teacher who's in the classroom. And he's asking where this kid is. And eventually, in his scanning of the classroom, he sees another kid that he recognized from the earlier fight, and he called out his name. And the kid stood up in his seat and said something back to Gator, at which point Gator ran toward him with the bat. So now Gator started chasing this kid. The teacher who was in the room started chasing Gator. And the teachers had apprehended me in the hallway, just outside the door, and rather than them taking me into custody or doing something with me, the moment they saw Gator start chasing this kid, they pushed me into the room, told me not to move, and they started chasing Gator. Immediately, the classroom just erupted into total chaos. People were out of their seats, and, you know, this kind of whole almost comical, if it didn't end in such tragedy, this chase was going on in this room, and eventually, the teachers managed to get to Gator. They wrestled him to the floor. And the entire time this was taking place, I was standing just inside the doorway. And my mind was racing. I was having all these thoughts about how I had to do something to stand up for my friends, that I had to, you know, I had to send a message. And I just began to panic, thinking that, you know, I was going to freeze up again like I had at the earlier fight in the morning, and I didn't want to let that happen again. And it was just kind of very chaotic, everything that was going on in my head. And then I saw the kid that Gator had been chasing circle around the back of the room and stop in the aisle just in front of me. At that point, kids were yelling back and forth. Gator and these other kids were jarring at each other about whatever, and my mind was in such a panic. I just thought to myself, I have to do something to send these kids a message. I have to show people I'm not afraid to stand up for myself. And so I took the knife that I had carried since I was probably 11 or 12 years old, I had in my pocket, and I walked up to the kid that Gator had been chasing, and I stabbed him one time in the stomach. And I tried to walk away like nothing happened. When I got to the doorway, some other teachers that were coming into the room from adjacent classrooms grabbed me and they patted me down, and they found the knife in my pocket, at which point they escorted me and Gator downstairs to the principal's office where the police were already waiting. They had been called when they first saw us come into school, and so they eventually took me and Gator into custody, and I was arrested for trespassing. The police were trying to ask questions about, you know, from other teachers and, you know, people of what happened. And I just, you know, I immediately told the police, like, that the knife was mine, that I'm the one who did it. And, you know, there was this tremendous conflict going on in my head at that point, in terms of you know, there was a part of me that felt like I had done the right thing, that I had stood up for my friends, and that, you know, for the first time, I had stood up for myself, and I didn't back down in a situation where I thought I should act. And, you know, there was a part of me, I was 16 years old, I had never been in any kind of trouble, and I was terrified of, you know, what kind of consequences there would be, but at the same time, I kind of thought that it wasn't a big deal, and that if I just explained my side of the story, you know, people would understand.
And you thought it was not a big deal because you didn't expect the kid to die, right?
And that's correct. So at that point, I was, you know, told that I would be charged with assault and battery, possibly even, you know, the charges could be attempted murder, which, you know, in my head at 16, I was thinking, you know, that's preposterous, and I didn't, you know, try to kill anyone. But they also told me that because I was a juvenile, when my mother got there, you know, to the police station, that they would release me to her custody. And so I sat for about 6 or 8 hours in a cell waiting for my mother, and it seemed, of course, to me, in that those circumstances, I thought I was there for like 2 or 3 days. It was about 6 or 7 hours, and at that point, an officer came into the cell, and he introduced himself, and he said, you know, Mr. Reed, as a result of, you know, you're aware of the incident that took place at Dartmouth High today, and I said, yes, I was, and he said, as a result of that incident, a young man had died, and you're now being charged with his murder. You know, as often as I tell this story, you know, I tell people that, you know, one of the saddest things that I live with is that in that moment, I was so self-absorbed that I couldn't even really process what he was saying. All I could think about was how much trouble I was in, and, you know, it was very, you know, I think it was probably a shock to me, and it was very hard for me to comprehend, but at the same time, you know, there was that naive, you know, that selfishness of, you know, a 16-year-old who's concerned about their own welfare, and that's very, you know, it's one of the saddest things for me, is that in that moment I couldn't, at the very least, be, you know, concerned about the life that I took and the harm that I caused.
But this is an area in which you developed tremendously, as we see through the book. We're speaking with Carter Reed and with Gene Traunstein, who is the author of a book about Carter Reed's story called Boy with the Knife. The next sort of development in the story is that you, Carter, were tried as an adult.
Gene, I wanted to jump in here a second, David. Can I just jump in and say something about, before we go on to that?
Yeah.
The being tried as an adult? Because I think it's really important, first of all, to mention when Carter and Gator went in, when they killed Jason Robinson, well, Carter killed Jason Robinson, the situation of going into that room is so appalling in a certain way, in a classroom. They were so... It was almost as if, how could you not know they were going to be caught? They were going to be caught. It just shows so totally what kids are like when they do things that are, you know, in the heat of the moment. And I think it's really important to mention that these were kids, and so obviously acting as kids, and that is something that we know now that we didn't really take into account at that time. Thanks. I just wanted to.
But this was the era of language like super predator, and this was a trial, as I understand from your book, Gene, in which Carter was presented as a cool and calculating killing monster, as well as someone who took joy and glee in murder and so forth, all of which you suggest was false, and of course all of which has nothing to do with any sort of correction or reparation for the damage, but that was how he was put on trial, as quote-unquote as an adult, but also as some sort of a monster, right?
Mm-hmm, exactly. At the time, we didn't have the laws. They were changed really around the time of super predator, that whole term that came into vogue. We didn't have laws that sent kids to adult facilities the way we have now, but that was a result of fear that kids were going to keep, that the crime rate was going to keep rising, which it has not, and that many states change laws so that kids as young as 12 are automatically tried as adults. In Massachusetts, Carter had, his lawyer had essentially tried to prove he was capable of change, but he was deemed, quote, not capable of change, and that is why he was sent to an adult, he was tried as an adult and put in an adult prison.
And this is the sort of cartoon view that a lot of people are given of the world, that there are good human beings and bad human beings, and you catch the bad ones and put them in a so-called correctional institution, but don't bother trying to correct anything because that's hopeless. Is this the perspective that you're trying to counter with this book?
I think I'm trying to show what really was in Carter's mind, that's one thing, what he really went through, as he just so eloquently explained, the kind of thinking he had and kids have is so without thinking of the consequences, they're kids. And I'm definitely trying to counter the idea that there's a monster behind that. Even again, back to the Supreme Court, even the most heinous of acts that is committed by a child is still committed by a child. And I think we have to really stop thinking of them, as you said, with cartoonish, sort of exaggerated, you know, comic book-like, with vengeance, really. It's not about vengeance. It's about many other things, thoughtlessness perhaps, but not vengeance and not maliciousness.
Carter, very briefly, you seem to have found a way to make friends in prison, educate yourself, improve yourself, and write letters to authors and lawyers who could help you make parole and get out. Was this sort of a struggle against the prison system? Are you an exception to the rule, or was it a system that really tried to help you?
Well, I'd like to say that I definitely don't think I'm the exception to the rule, because I've encountered so many people who are, very similar to me in so many ways, people who made tremendous efforts to change themselves, to better themselves, to become hopefully one day productive citizens. And unfortunately, a lot of them may never get that opportunity, which is probably the primary reason that I speak out on behalf of all those people who are, very much care about and very much respect as, human beings. But I think at the same time, the system is not, it's simply not designed, despite the fact that it's across the Department of Corrections, it's not designed to rehabilitate. There are rehabilitative elements of the system, and there are rehabilitative elements in place that people can take part in and participate in. But ultimately, it comes down to the individual, and I often say, that I got lucky. I encountered the right people at the right time to get me on the right path, point me in the right direction. And I had, for whatever reason that I can't really account for, but I had that internal desire. And a lot of that came from some growth that took place in me that I don't feel like I had any conscious effort or decision in. Just basically a natural maturation process. I matured, and in that process, I just basically developed this idea, within myself that it was important for me to better myself, to participate in these programs, to try to help others, to share my message with people. And again, it's something that I honestly feel is in some instances, just a stroke of luck and good fortune that, I found myself in positions that I did. I think that you know, and for a lot of it, it was necessary to, you know, fight against the system, as it were. And so I think the idea is that I didn't succeed because of the system. I succeeded in spite of the system. And I'm not by any means the only person who's done so.
There are, as I understand... yes, Jean?
Oh, I was going to say, on the other hand, I think that there are a lot of kids who in a way are much more beaten down by being housed as adults. Carter had some stroke of fortune. His father was there with him for a piece of it. He had people kind of tell him how to do things, and some people from his neighborhood and so on. A lot of kids just can't make it, and they're destroyed by being put in with adults. I think it's tragic.
And there are some 10,000 kids in adult prisons in the United States right now?
Right, and I think the book aims to say we need to stop doing this. We need to stop. Carter is a success story. There's no doubt about it. On the other hand, he shows us that all kids are capable of change. They really are all capable, maybe not as smart as Carter and not as articulate, but as he says, there are a lot of people like him, and we really underestimate that.
There's now a treaty that every single nation on the planet except the United States has ratified called the Convention on the Rights of the Child that would prevent putting children in adult prisons. Is that right? And should
right.
the United States join the rest of the world on that?
Right. I think there are two countries. We're one of two countries that hasn't signed it.
Somalia.
And, right.
Somalia has not ratified it?
Right.
I believe they... Well, last I heard, that was generally referred to as one of only two countries that hasn't ratified the United Nations Article 37, Rights of a Child. But last time I heard a Harvard professor mention it, he said we're the only one. So I'm going to think maybe Somalia came around and we haven't.
Yes, it was two. It was three. It was two. I the last I heard, it was down to one. In any case, it is a small minority.
We haven't, which is shocking, really, if you think about it. It's just ridiculous. I mean, it's crazy.
It is incredibly crazy, and I wish we could go on for hours, but we're running out of time here. I highly recommend this book. We can't scratch the surface on this radio show, but it is called Boy with a Knife, A Story of Murder, Remorse, and a Prisoner's Fight for Justice by Jean Trounstein, with the epilogue by Carter Reed. Jean and Carter, thank you both very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, David. Appreciate this opportunity.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. I'm traveling around the United States right now doing events with my new book, War is a Lie, second edition. I hope to see you. Find the schedule of events at warisalie.org. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersteam.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the 1964 New York City murder of Kitty Genovese started as a personal tragedy and a tiny item on a New York Times back page. Within months, it had become an internationally known emblematic tale. Not about Genovese, whose life most reports dispensed with quickly with the phrase Queen's barmaid, or about her killer, Winston Mosley, but about the neighbors, 38 of them, we were told, who reportedly watched Genovese die in the street, but did nothing, didn't come to her aid or call the police. They just, we heard, didn't want to get involved. The idea of urban apathy struck a deep cultural chord that resonates to this day. But what if the story we've all heard isn't true? Marcia Gallo is assistant professor of history at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and the author of the book No One Helped, Kitty Genovese, New York City, and the Myth of Urban Apathy. The book disentangles the story from the reality of Genovese's death and her life and explores the social and historical context in which the fable was created. We'll hear from Marcia Gallo today on Counterspin. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press. As of May 10th, the fires in Canada's tar sands had burned nearly 800 square miles in the province of Alberta. Some 90,000 people in the Fort McMurray area have had to flee their homes. Network TV News is covering the fire, but you'll get much more by way of dramatic visuals than information about causes. As Miles Grant reports for FAIR.org, from May 2nd to the 9th, CBS News mentioned Canada's wildfires 11 times, ABC 10 times, and NBC 4 times. None of the stories mentioned global warming's role in contributing to the hot, dry conditions that make forests ripe for wildfires. CBS alone mentioned why Fort McMurray had suddenly sprung up in the middle of an old-growth forest, and they used the term oil sands, which the Canadian oil industry prefers to the more accurate tar sands, sandy, sticky clumps converted to energy in an extremely dirty, costly process. Science has long made the link between climate change and increasing, more intense wildfires. The National Wildlife Federation explains warming temperatures are leading to longer fire seasons, drier conditions, and more lightning to spark fires. Print coverage made the connection, more times than zero anyway. Grant found climate change mentioned 32 times in 489 articles, though mainly in sidebars or follow-ups rather than the main story. But on TV, while CBS told viewers, quote, parts of Alberta are literally hell on earth, close quote, the only causes mentioned were lightning and drought. The massive inferno is feeding on dry forest, NBC explained, with no accounting for why tinder dry forests are becoming more common. TV's overarching theme was one of battle, with man as the protagonist and nature as the villain to be beaten back. Factoring in the contributions of global warming and tar sands production would complicate that simple story. Well, it's not often that a study from a D.C. policy group generates dozens of media stories on its release, but one from the Urban Institute burned up the wires, from Bloomberg to PBS. One outlet, The Washington Post, devoted four pieces to it, two news stories, an AP report, and an editorial, in one afternoon. The study says that Bernie Sanders' domestic proposals would add some $18 trillion to the national debt. In case you didn't see that as a frighteningly big number, The Washington Post wrote out all the zeros for the headline of their first hot take, "Sorry, Bernie fans, his health care plan is short $17 trillion." Next, we had "Confirmed, Sanders is selling a fantasy agenda," followed by the AP write-up that referred to blowing an $18 trillion hole in federal deficits. None of these reports offered any criticism of the study, which would have been easy enough to come by. David Himmelstein and Steffi Woolhandler of Physicians for a National Health Program called the study's cost estimates ridiculous, pointing out that they ignore the experience of other countries with single-payer systems, all of which spend far less per person than the U.S. The Institute report assumes there will be 100 million more doctor visits per year, even though the plan doesn't involve an increase in the number of doctors. It supposes that the state would pay 50% more for prescription drugs than Medicaid currently pays, for some reason, and it minimizes the administrative savings that are a key asset of a unified system. Smart people can disagree, but for the Post to pretend there are no experts who support Sanders' numbers is dishonest. And what's it in aid of, given that the paper has made clear it thinks Sanders has no electoral chance? Well, the End of the Day editorial shed some light. Under the headline, "Sanders' plans aren't just too good to be true, they're also fiscally dangerous," the paper explained that Sanders is trying to tilt the party platform leftward. And while that's for Democrats to deal with, it's, quote, "also of interest to anyone who believes that political parties should offer realistic solutions." In that sense, the prospect of a Sandersized platform is cause for concern, close quote. Issue areas Sanders might mess up: the Post lists taxes, health care, Social Security, and college tuition. Elite media claim their concern about Sanders is that he couldn't possibly achieve the things he's promising. Now and again, it seems clear that their fear is that anyone actually might. And finally, The Washington Post's Ruth Marcus May 11th column offered the speech she said House Speaker Paul Ryan should give to Republicans in order to disassociate himself from Donald Trump. Funny thing is, Dean Baker notes on fair.org, she seems to be encouraging him to lie. Among other things, Marcus says Ryan should say, quote, "I have spent my life believing in and fighting for the ideals of the Republican Party: limited government, fiscal responsibility, free trade and free markets, the United States' role as the world's most important force for peace and liberty. It is not clear to me which, if any, of those convictions Mr. Trump shares," close quote. But Ryan doesn't want limited government. He wants pretty much no government. His budgets call for zeroing out everything except Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and the military by 2050. No money for an FDA or a State Department, for that matter. Marcus says he should say he wants to get entitlement spending under control. But if Ryan were really being honest, he'd say he wants to privatize Social Security and Medicare. As a major supporter of stronger and longer patent and copyright protection, Ryan can't claim to support free trade and free markets. And as for fiscal responsibility, he's proposed huge tax cuts that would go disproportionately to the wealthy, which he claims will be offset by ending deductions he's never named. It's easy enough to see why Marcus might want Ryan to distance himself from Trump. It's harder to see why she wants him to claim positions he doesn't hold. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Few events have gone from fact to fable as quickly and decisively as that of the 1964 killing of Kitty Genovese. For decades, we've heard references to the poor young woman stabbed again and again on a New York City street while some 38 people, Genovese's neighbors, watched from their windows without making a move to help. In some tellings, some of them pulled up chairs for a better view. But in all tellings, the community's apathy was the reason for Genovese's death almost as much as her killer, Winston Mosley, whose death in prison last month brought the story briefly back into the headlines. You may have heard that the tale calls for some asterisks, maybe not quite 38 people. Maybe they didn't say precisely the infamous words, "I didn't want to get involved." But the work of our next guest shows that the Kitty Genovese story goes well beyond a case of reporters missing some details. Marcia Gallo is assistant professor of history at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. She's the author of No One Helped: Kitty Genovese, New York City, and the Myth of Urban Apathy. She joins us now by phone from Wilmington, Delaware. Welcome to Counterspin, Marcia Gallo.
Thank you, Janice.
Well, so much is about her death, of course, and one of the key things about your book is how it illuminates her life. So let's start there. Before the New York Times story, before what happened to her that night, tell us something about what Kitty Genovese was like.
Oh, yes. From all accounts, she was somebody who was a lot of fun to know. Everyone from her family members to her lover to her best friends to the people that worked with her, all of them talk about this vibrant, lively, intelligent, inquisitive woman who at 28 was making a really great life for herself in Queens, New York. She had grown up in Brooklyn, was the oldest of five children of an Italian-American family, and very, very close to the family. But one of the things that Kitty also was incredibly independent. And when in the late 50s, the family decided that crime was getting a little too much for them, they decided to move the family to Connecticut, to New Canaan. And Kitty decided that she would not follow. Even in the late 50s and early 60s, which is pretty significant, especially for a woman steeped in certain cultural traditions of family and home and domesticity, she recognized that she wanted something else. So she moved to Queens and found work and found an apartment and found friends and lovers, but never let go of that family tie. And I think that's one of the things that first attracted me to her. The other thing, of course, was that she drove a red Fiat in 1964 around New York City, which is quite remarkable for, again, a young woman of her time.
I do want to take you now to March 12, 1964, and we'll begin talking about the story of it. But first, let's talk about the facts of it. What, as best we now know, can we say did happen on the night of March 12th?
It's always important to remember that the facts come from the murderer. The only person who was the actual witness to the crime from beginning to end, of course, was Winston Mosley. And so his account given to the police just a few days after the crime was committed is that he went out that evening, as he had done at least a couple of times previously, as he put it, looking for a woman to kill. Now, this is a man, also 28, African-American, also lived in Queens in nearby Hollis. He had a very good job. He had absolutely no police record. He was a family man with kids. But he obviously had this horrible proclivity, which led him to misogynist assaults. So he went out early in the morning of the 13th, Friday the 13th, actually, and drove around looking for a woman, spotted Kitty. It might have been that red Fiat, unfortunately, and followed her. She was heading home. It was about 3 a.m. She had been at the bar that she managed in Hollis called Ev's 11th Hour, and she managed the bar. She had been there that evening, went out for dinner with a friend, came back to help close up. So at 3 a.m., she's doing what she did many, many, many times, and she's driving home, probably a little too fast. And he spots her and follows her. He follows her all the way to Kew Gardens. She pulls into the Long Island Railroad Station there and parks her car as she always did. And according to him, spots him over her shoulder. And he starts running toward her. She is running away from him up Austin Street toward, I think, a neighborhood bar that was on the corner. But it was closed. Mosley catches up to her, stabs her in the back a number of times, and Kitty is screaming for her life. A neighbor hears her and raises his window, yells down, "Leave that girl alone, hey you." Mosley runs away, and Kitty is able to make it around the corner and into the first apartment door right on the LIR tracks and collapses on the floor. Mosley, after he runs away, waits. He gets in his car, he waits, he changes his hat, and then he returns, spots her in this vestibule, goes inside, and then proceeds to stab her again in the lungs and then attempt to rape her as she is, again, screaming for help, but much more feebly. She's extremely wounded and bleeding heavily by this point. And she's off the street, and no one really could see her. someone opens the door at the top of the stairs. Mosley realizes he's been spotted, and he takes her wallet and runs away. The person at the top of the stairs, who's a friend of Kitty's, is in complete shock, but he does get it together enough to call a friend and then call the police, and the ambulance arrives within minutes, and unfortunately, Kitty dies on the way to the hospital. But not by herself. A neighbor came to her as soon as the man at the top of the stairs alerted her and cradled Kitty in her arms as they waited for the ambulance. I think that detail is significant because it shows that this is not what was then made out to be true. This was a neighborhood of people who, once they knew that their Kitty was in trouble, acted.
The meaning, so-called, from the Kitty Genovese story that we hear today is very, very different in elements and in its overarching feeling. But let's trace now, then, the story. What does the very first reporting look like?
The best reporting immediately is from the local paper. The Long Island Press, in particular, really did an excellent job of telling the story without malice or without exaggeration, but they're a local paper. It's the New York Times that initially buries the story on page 28. Queens woman stabbed to death in front of home. I mean, that's the headline. But the newly named Metropolitan editor of the Times, A.M. Rosenthal, who has been back in New York less than a year after 10 years abroad. And part of what he does is make sure that he is in touch with all the opinion makers in town, including the police commissioner. So about a week after the crime, which he doesn't even notice in the back pages of the paper, he has lunch with Police Commissioner Murphy. And Murphy, who's also from Queens, says to him, "You know, this crime in Queens the other day is one for the books. You got to check it out." Basically feeds him the story of the frustration of the Queens detectives and police officers when they could not get the neighbors to even open their doors to talk to them. They were very frustrated because they just weren't getting the kind of help from the community that they expected. So that's the story that the commissioner feeds Rosenthal. Rosenthal then assigns a veteran copy editor, Martin Gansberg, who was eager to do more reporting, to go to Queens, investigate, talk to the cops, etc. Gansberg meets with a very similar kind of refusal on the part of the neighbors. They don't want to talk to him. They don't want to see their name in print. They just want to forget this horrible thing ever happened in their neighborhood. They're still grieving. So that became the story of the 38 people who didn't want to help. It's very much filtered through the lens of the police frustration with the neighbors' lack of assistance in their investigation.
It's a news story, but then it's a theme, you know, and the New York Times really kind of goes all in for 6 weeks with other stories. And one of the things you learn is that even Kitty's girlfriend, Marianne Zelenko, believed the reporting that she was reading, that no one had gone to Kitty's aid. Isn't that true? So the reporting kind of takes on a life of its own. And then we get up to the big piece, the May 3rd piece from Rosenthal. Tell us about that.
Within 2 weeks of the crime, we're learning next to nothing about the victim, except for her name, her age, and the fact that she was a bar manager. We know almost nothing about the perpetrator, who, and this is almost never mentioned, is caught 6 days later because of neighbors in Corona who take action because they see him burglarizing a house. Now, that could have been the lead, right?
Right.
Murderer caught because neighbors get involved. But no, the apathy trope was so potent that that's what the story became about. And then May 3rd is the Sunday magazine piece that Rosenthal pens about the sickness of apathy. And that becomes the template for the book, his only book, that's published about a month later, called 38 Witnesses. This apathy theme not only resonates with New Yorkers, it goes viral. And everyone around the world is starting to comment on, oh my goodness, what's happening to us as a people. Psychologists weigh in, ministers weigh in, even Surgeon General Everett Koop weighs in. I mean, so many people are commenting on the story that, as you say, it takes on a life of its own, fueled by A.M. Rosenthal.
As you say, we get bystander syndrome, a whole kind of psychological thing. We get Good Samaritan laws. Many people may not know that 911 did not exist at 1964,
right.
And that's one of the things that comes out of it. I can tell you from personal experience, it still affects CPR training. I was told, mm-hmm. Don't just say someone call 911. You have to pick an individual and tell them to call. Otherwise, no one will call. The cultural impact is manifest, and yet the cultural impact in some ways results from a fable. Part of the reason it's discomforting is the way that it fits within the social climate of the time. Rosenthal is complaining about apathy at a time that really was a time of serious social activism, and that disconnect is problematic. Can you talk a little about that?
I originally thought that he would be just the straight-up villain in the story, and there are certainly things to criticize him for, there's no question about it, including not insisting that the reporting be much more in-depth. However, remember that Rosenthal had just come back from postings around the world, but his special kind of, where he won his only Pulitzer Prize as a newsman, is in Eastern Europe. And he wrote this very powerful piece about Auschwitz, where he talks about Auschwitz being turned into, as he put it, the most grisly tourist site on earth. And it leads him into this conversation about the good German and about people turning their backs, turning away from evil in their midst and not taking action, not taking personal responsibility. And that becomes the linchpin for him, right? So he discounts, oddly enough, the social activism that's taking place in New York at that time on so many levels, and instead aims at what he sees as a failure of personal responsibility. That's what he's preaching, and he's using the Times as his bully pulpit. We need to care about one another one-on-one. Forget this social activism. Forget the committees and the fundraisers and the marches and the protests. That's not going to do anything to change things. It has to start one-on-one.
I think it's possible to appreciate Rosenthal's call for person-to-person responsibility and still question his put-down of social activism. He really does, if folks go back and read that essay, mm-hmm. there's a lot of twisting and turning going on that makes apathy a very useful device to mean many things that Rosenthal himself does not like. Black people are apathetic towards other black people because sometimes they call them Uncle Toms, it's a useful thing for him, which is not to say that there is not a core idea in it that has resonance.
No, the thing that was the most stunning to me after him blaming sort of everybody who had ever joined an organization for avoiding personal responsibility by joining collective action, which makes no sense, was that he specifically went after white women, who he called out, especially in his book, but also I think in that article, for their hypocrisy, as if somehow their political actions didn't match their personal lives. And I think I know exactly who he was talking about, an amazing integration activist named Ellen Lurie, who had her entire life been involved in the struggles for equitable schools in New York City, was in the pages of the Times over and over and over again for her fearless activism around race and segregation. So that was the thing that just stunned me the most, in addition to him taking on people who had gotten involved. It was his sort of very specific denigration of this particular woman and her activism. But the other thing that still really one can't escape is the way in which an entire neighborhood was defamed, really. I mean, they were made out to be these horrible people. And it is still, when you mention Kew Gardens, many, many people go, oh, yeah, that's where that girl was killed and nobody helped.
And, you know, we were just talking last week about gang raids in public housing, and it's the same kind of thing that can happen where protecting a community becomes accusing even the victims of crime as being somehow culpable. You know, communities in which crime occurs become criminal communities.
Yes.
Well, almost every story of imperfect journalism or troubling journalism is also a story of good journalism, and that's true here. You mentioned earlier Long Island Press, which from the beginning talked about Kitty as a whole person, you know, right from the start. But The New York Times, we should be clear, has revisited the original kind of fableization.
Jim Rassenberger, in 2004, as a freelancer, does some amazing investigative work and finds Marianne Zelenko. So for 40 years, not only was Kitty sort of erased as a crime victim, and we knew almost next to nothing about her, but her lover is also erased, even though the police had brought her in for questioning, brought in all their friends. Everyone knew, including Rosenthal, that there was a woman that Kitty not only shared her apartment with, but her life. Rassenberger finds Zelenko and convinces her to speak with him. And for the first time, we get the voice of someone who knew a whole other side of Kitty and Kitty's life. The other news person that did amazing work in 1984 was a man named John Melia, who had been writing for Queens newspapers for years. And when I talked to him a couple years ago, he said to me, you know, the story never smelled right. It just didn't fit what we knew about that neighborhood. And we kept saying, we shouldn't run with this. But they were overruled because it was the New York Times.
We've been speaking with Marcia Gallo, Assistant Professor of History at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. The book is No One Helped, Kitty Genovese, New York City, and the Myth of Urban Apathy. It's out now from Cornell University Press. Marcia Gallo, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much, Janine. I really appreciate it.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A huge scientific paper published by James Hansen and a group of international scientists contains dire warnings about how climate change will hit us. Perhaps none is more astounding than a prediction of superstorms this century greater than anything seen in human times. I don't have the scientific training to say this Hansen-led paper is right about superstorms or when they will come. In fact, it's hard to imagine storms we've never experienced, things not even perhaps described in ancient legends. But if Hansen is right, what would they look like? We can get help on that from one of the world's premier experts on violent weather. That would be Dr. Jeff Masters, the meteorologist who has flown into the eye of hurricanes, chased storms, he provides weather forecasts, and he writes regularly for the Weather Underground. Jeff, thank you for joining us again on Radio EcoShock.
Sure, Alex. Happy to be here.
Well, why don't we start here? What is the strongest storm recorded with modern instruments, say, in the last 100 years?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because back in the early 1960s, there was a typhoon in the Pacific called Nancy where they thought it had 215-mile-per-hour sustained winds. But that was taken with some very primitive sort of hurricane hunter measuring equipment. I mean, they didn't have modern GPS or inertial navigation, and that was basically just an estimate that was not deemed very reliable. So we thought for a long time that, you know, really there's never been a tropical cyclone worldwide that's had 200-mile-per-hour winds. But that changed last year. Back in October, we had a hurricane off the Pacific coast of Mexico, a hurricane named Patricia, that was measured by the hurricane hunters to have winds of 215 miles per hour. That's not a gust, that's sustained. Those are the winds you encounter in a high-end EF5 tornado, so absolutely devastating sort of winds. Fortunately, that hurricane weakened before it made landfall as a Category 4 storm with 150-mile-an-hour winds.
And do we know of great storms in earlier centuries, even if we don't have the instruments?
You know, we do. There are a lot of records of hurricanes going back to colonial times, and in particular, there's a hurricane called the Great Hurricane, which occurred during the American Revolutionary War back in 1780. Now, the Great Hurricane was one of the Cape Verde-type storms that come off the coast of Africa and then impact the Lesser Antilles Islands. And in October of 1780, when it moved ashore over Barbados, the winds of that hurricane were so strong that it leveled every tree on the island, destroyed every structure on the island, destroyed the forts, took the heavy two-ton cannons and threw them hundreds of feet away from the forts. And not only did it fell all the trees, but it took the bark off the trees, which is a phenomenon we've never, ever seen in any other tropical cyclone in history. But we do see in EF5 tornadoes, those type of tornadoes with 200-mile-per-hour winds. So the theory is that the Great Hurricane of 1780 may have been one of these freak storms that, you know, one in 1,000-year type of storms that did have EF5 tornado winds in it.
All right. Now, getting to the Hansen paper, Ice Melt, Sea Level Rise, and Superstorms, my understanding of that, and I'm pretty limited, is a shift in ocean currents in the North Atlantic brought on by ever faster melting on Greenland will create conditions that could lead to giant storms. Is that what you get from it?
Sure. I mean, what you're seeing is that the ocean temperatures in particular are going to increase because of not only global warming, but also a shift in the ocean currents. And in fact, we can maybe see a little bit of a beginning of that right now in the North Atlantic. Most of the North Atlantic is hotter than usual. In fact, the ocean temperatures worldwide have been at record or near record levels over the past year due to, you know, global warming and an ongoing El Nino event. But if you look in the North Atlantic by Iceland, there's this unusual cool spot. In fact, it's near record cold. Ocean temperatures are observed there. And the thought is that maybe that's due to the fact that this ocean current shift is starting to begin. The Gulf Stream current is carrying less warm water to the north than it used to, which causes a little bit of a cool water spot to develop up there. And since less warm water is being transported up there, that means there's more warm water further south in the Atlantic to pile up and cause warmer ocean conditions. So, yeah, I mean, we expect the oceans to warm over the coming century. And just a 2 or 3 degree increase in the warmth of oceans, that's enough to potentially drive superstorms. And in fact, Hurricane Patricia last year that formed off the coast of Mexico, that took advantage of the warmest ocean waters ever recorded in that portion of the ocean. So that helped fuel its rise to 215-mile-per-hour winds.
So is it fair to say that the mechanics of storm creation described in the paper, if they develop, would agree with what we know from meteorology today?
Yeah, theory supports the idea that if you crank up the thermostat, you're going to crank up the intensity of hurricanes. They're heat engines that extract heat energy from the ocean and convert it to the mechanical energy of their winds. You provide more heat in, and you're going to get stronger winds coming out. And it's very interesting. In fact, if you actually crank up the thermostat way high to, say, 120 degrees at the surface, which is ridiculous as far as, you know, something we're not going to see in the next century or two due to global warming, but if you can somehow get the thermostat that high, you can get what are called hypercanes, which are kind of off-the-scale sort of hurricanes that have wind speeds over 500 miles per hour, central pressures down to 700 millibars, which is like only 70% of atmospheric pressure. And these storms go way to the top of the stratosphere. And we wouldn't want to see one of these storms because it can basically rearrange the entire climate system, cause destruction of the global ozone layer, and throw enough moisture high in the atmosphere that it'll block out the sun and cause kind of a volcanic winter scenario. So the models, you know, they're very clear. You provide more energy to the system, you're going to get stronger storms.
And Jeff, one of our scientific guests talked about baroclinicity, and I didn't really know what it means. What does that mean in meteorology?
Yeah, there's two main ways that storms get energy. One is through the energy of the ocean waters, like hurricanes do. And what they do is they take water vapor off of the ocean, and the water vapor holds what we call latent heat, which means the heat that was required to convert it to vapor form. It maintains that energy, and when the water condenses, or when the vapor condenses into water, it releases that energy and powers the storm. Now, there's another source of energy for storms called baroclinicity, and all that means it's the difference between cold air and warm air, basically, or cold, dense air and warm, moist air. And what happens is that if you've got cold, dense air up high in the atmosphere and it sinks and is replaced by warm, moist air, which is less dense near the surface, then that's a release of potential energy. You've got basically an object falling, and as it falls, it releases its energy and helps power the storm. And that's the energy source that blizzards use to get going, and the normal sort of low-pressure systems that, you know, march every few days across the mid-latitudes.
Okay, the other impact raised by Hansen et al., in fact, part of their proof, is a pattern of towering waves descending on the Caribbean from these storms, and it's partly dependent on the length of the ocean, or fetch, as the mariners say. Have you heard anything about larger-than-normal waves in the age of climate change?
It's tough. We don't have very good wave observations going back very far, but there is some thought that, yes, wave heights are increasing in some portions of some of the oceans, and it would stand to make sense. I mean, if you've got more heat energy available, I mean, that's potentially more energy to drive stronger winds and make bigger waves. So, yeah, we could potentially have bigger waves because of climate change.
I often wondered if there's any physical limit to how high waves could be. I don't really know.
Well, if you've got a 500-mile-per-hour wind, you're probably going to be able to get 200-foot-high waves. I mean, we've seen 100-foot-high waves in the oceans in huge hurricane-force storms. But, yeah, if you crank up the wind speed, I don't see any reason to have even bigger waves than that.
The idea of black swans, where things that were thought to be impossible turn out to really exist, has become fairly popular now. But the American scientist Kerry Emanuel is worried about gray swans. Can you tell us about that, Jeff Masters?
A black swan is an event that's totally unexpected that you wouldn't think could occur based on historical records or physical understanding. But a gray swan is an event that hasn't occurred in historical times. But if you look at the physics of how the atmosphere behaves, then you think that, yeah, you know, something like this is possible. And one of these storms I think we've already had in the past is this great hurricane of 1780, 200-mile-per-hour winds. It was able to debark trees. No other storm has been able to do that in recorded history. And if we look at the physics of how the atmosphere behaves, these sorts of storms can be anticipated now because we have the physical understanding. We know how the climate's changing. And Dr. Emanuel's paper thought that a type of storm like the Great Hurricane of 1780, which maybe occurs only once every 1,000 years, can probably start occurring even more frequently than that with climate change, maybe by the end of the century, between one in every 400 years, or maybe even one in 60 years, depending on which climate model you're using. So I don't like those odds very good. I mean, yeah, a one in 100-year event doesn't sound very probable, but if you integrate over a 30-year period, then, you know, you keep rolling the dice, a 1% chance every year adds up, and then you have a 26% chance of a one in 100-year event happening. So basically, his Gray Swan paper is saying a hurricane like the Great Hurricane of 1780, you know, we're going to start seeing those by the end of the century. They're going to be, you know, once every 60 or 100 years on average, they're going to start popping up, whereas before you'd only expect one every 1,000 years.
And MIT seems to suggest that, with based on this Emanuel paper, that these storms could pop up in places we haven't expected, maybe even in the Middle East.
Yeah, it's kind of strange to think, but yeah, the Persian Gulf and the Red Sea, those have the hottest ocean temperatures of any bodies of water on the planet, and they are potentially going to get some pretty incredible storms. Those hot ocean temperatures are going to get even hotter with climate change, and yeah, we could see a Category 4 storm forming and hitting Dubai, maybe, and causing unprecedented havoc with the oil and gas industry.
That would change prices at the pump as well.
Well, you know, we need to get over onto solar and wind as soon as possible for a lot of reasons, and that's one. I mean, the whole infrastructure for the oil and gas industry is highly vulnerable to storms, and it already has been disrupted by a number of storms in the past. I'm thinking Hurricane Katrina caused a big disruption to the Gulf of Mexico oil and gas industry. And certainly the Middle East is prone to disruptions as well. There have been an increasing number of very strong storms in the Arabian Sea in recent years. In fact, we had two of them hit the country of Yemen last year, and that was an unprecedented occurrence, two Category 3 or stronger storms. So, yeah, this sort of thing is something to think about when we're planning our energy infrastructure.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, meteorologist and storm expert, Dr. Jeff Masters. Let's move to the Southern Hemisphere, Jeff. We've seen awful, deadly tropical cyclones already there this century. It's hard to imagine they could get worse, but could they?
You know, it's very interesting and a little worrisome. When you look at the global database for strong tropical cyclones, which is the catch-all term that we use to describe hurricanes and typhoons and what they simply call tropical cyclones in the southern hemisphere, we haven't ever seen a storm as strong as we had this year back in February. Tropical Cyclone Winston, 185-mile-per-hour winds hit Fiji as a Category 5 storm, devastating that island, its most expensive natural disaster in history. So, yeah, the southern hemisphere had its strongest tropical cyclone in history this year. And over in the Indian Ocean, the southern Indian Ocean had its strongest tropical cyclone in history this year as well. Back in April, a storm called Fantala, 175-mile-per-hour winds. So in the span of just 8 months, we've seen the strongest tropical cyclone ever recorded in the South Indian Ocean. That was Fantala. The strongest ever recorded in the South Pacific. That was Winston, 185-mile-per-hour winds. And the strongest tropical cyclone ever recorded in the Northern Hemisphere, or the entire globe, actually, and that was Hurricane Patricia, with its 215-mile-per-hour winds back in October. So, you know, you look at that and you say, wow, I mean, if that isn't a warning shot over our bow, then what is? Maybe hearteningly, if you look at the longer-term statistics going back to 1990, which is the beginning of the good satellite record globally, we really can't say we see an increase in these most powerful of storms. I mean, the database isn't very long, though, and not very good. So the jury's out right now whether we're actually starting to see these changes. Certainly, climate models are expecting to see them. We expect the strongest storms to get stronger, but it's going to be a matter of decades probably before we can draw the line and connect the dots and say, okay, it's happening.
You know, in a recent program, we heard from a leader of the Carteret Islands. That's a chain in Papua New Guinea, which is being washed over by the sea to the point where they may become the first permanent climate refugees. If Hansen and his team are right, islands in different parts of the world may become uninhabitable in the next few decades, they're saying. What do you think?
Yeah, certainly sea level rise is already nibbling away at a number of islands. There's an island off the coast of Louisiana that is going to have to move, and they're in the process of trying to find the money to do it. A couple islands off the coast of Alaska, Kivalina, looks like they're going to have to move because of erosion problems due to rising seas. And that's going to continue to increase in coming decades. There's going to be, you know, a lot of trouble maintaining the defenses against the rising sea. And we're just simply going to have to abandon some areas because it's just not going to be cost-effective anymore to keep on putting up these barriers and replenishing beaches and so on. It's got to stop at some point. We've got to draw the line and say, okay, it's time to retreat.
Yes, and after every big cyclone or hurricane, politicians immediately promise, we will rebuild. They say that even in the lowest parts of Louisiana after Katrina or the most exposed parts of the East Coast after Sandy. I wonder when they'll start to say, we will relocate.
You know, it's written into the law. The part of the law for FEMA called the Stafford Act says that when we lose a chunk of land due to a storm surge, we have to put all the infrastructure back on that land. And there's a part of Alabama called Dauphin Island, which is off the coast. It's a barrier island. The western end of that island has been basically destroyed four or five times by hurricanes in the past 20 years, most recently in Hurricane Katrina. And the entire end of the island was washed away and moved. Oh, actually, it was moved closer to the coast by, you know, several hundred yards. And what the Army Corps had to do by law is go and dredge the sucker, put it back where it was, fill in the island, and put the streets and all the power lines and the sewers back there, because that's what the law said they had to do. And guess what? We paid for it. And there are several other places that are that way, too, barrier islands that are getting washed away more frequently in storm surges. And right now, the way the law is written is we got to keep on doing something that probably doesn't make sense. I mean, we've got to retreat from some of these barrier islands and take our time to put our resources where it makes more sense, defend parts of the coast that are worth defending, where they're more heavily populated and not so vulnerable.
I hear a law that needs to be changed. Now, Jeff, I picture a situation where storms and storm surges wreck major cities time after time, to the point where we can no longer afford to rebuild, a kind of death by a thousand nasty weather events. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, there have been cities in the past that have been abandoned due to multiple hurricane strikes. Indianola, I think is how you pronounce it, coastal city in Texas, got hit by a number of, I think, two different storm surges over a period of a few decades, and they basically abandoned the town. And that may be coming. I mean, certainly New Orleans is at risk. After Katrina, okay, they rebuilt the defenses. They put in $14 billion of new infrastructure. But if we get a Category 4 or 5 storm hitting New Orleans head-on, sort of a 1 in 200-year storm, then those defenses are not equipped to withstand that. And we may end up abandoning New Orleans in that case. I mean, the city will get flooded. The below-sea-level bowl will fill with water. And the people may just decide they don't want to come back. So we'll see. I mean, sea level rise, if Hansen is right, could be many meters by the end of the century, in which case we're going to start seeing not just one major city, but several probably have those sorts of reckoning, days of reckoning. The insurance industry is going to pull out, people are going to move, and we'll end up retreating.
Yes, and we didn't say the word Miami. Well, look, weather in the southern U.S. seems so strange lately. We've seen flooding and strings of tornadoes. Is that just part of life there, or do you think there's something unusual going on?
We've certainly seen that heavy downpours, the upper 1% of the spectrum, are increasing, not only in the U.S., but worldwide. And certainly the downpours in the south this past year are part of that trend. Now, they're also due to the fact we had an El Nino event, in fact, one of the strongest, if not the strongest on record. And when you get that sort of naturally occurring event, it changes storm tracks so that you get more heavy rain-bearing storms moving over the southern U.S. So, yeah, partially natural, partially climate change. We are seeing an increase in the heaviest rain events, and what we saw this past winter was part of that trend.
As we wrap up, I'd like to get your thoughts on the Hansen-led paper, Ice Melt, Sea Level Rise, and Superstorms. Did you form a general impression of the storm predictions in there?
Hansen tends to be at the upper end of the dire scenario sort of scientific ideas of what are out there. If you look at some of the literature by other climate scientists, they don't see such a dire scenario happening. But universally, I hear these more cautious-sounding climate scientists say, you know, Hansen could be right. You know, he's at the upper end, but the science and the theory, the modeling, all says is that, yeah, it could happen this way. And we got to take into account not only the most probable outcome, but the upper end sort of outcome, the outliers, because outliers do happen. And one thing we do know from past experience is surprises do happen. In fact, surprises are expected. We can't pigeonhole everything that's going to happen due to climate change because there's just too many variables. The climate's too chaotic and not well enough understood. We're going to get surprises, and some high-end surprises are more likely, unfortunately, than the low-end surprises, I think. We're going to get some off-scale disasters that we never saw coming, black swans. And, well, Hansen's giving us a gray swan sort of scenario here. I mean, we can anticipate some of this through theory and modeling.
I totally agree with what you've just said. Now, I haven't seen a Jeff Masters book about storms. Have you considered it?
I have a book, a fiction book I'm working on, which presents a sort of worst case scenario, or plausible, not even worst case, but how things could be in 20 or 30 years, or maybe even today if we get a very bad weather year. I mean, it's not a very big stretch of the imagination to think that we could get a flooding event like wiped out the Mississippi River levee system in 1927, combined with a Category 5 hurricane maybe making landfall, and other worldwide extreme weather events, droughts in China, flooding in Europe, causing a crash to the global agricultural system, causing worldwide chaos, basically. So, yeah, that's my novel. I'm thinking of toning it down, maybe, because I don't want it to be, you know, apocalyptic. I want to have some hope. And there is hope in this whole scenario. I mean, people are very creative and very resourceful. And, you know, we have some of the answers we need to keep a disastrous future from happening, like, you know, could if we keep on going business as usual. So that's what I'm working on. I don't know if I'll ever finish it. I've been working on it 5 years already, and it just seems I haven't had the time to really put into it to get it whipped into shape just because there's so much crazy weather to talk about on my blog all the time.
Well, that's the problem I have doing this show. I think I'm catching up, and then so many jaw-dropping things happen that you can't cover it all. I'm Alex Smith. We've been talking with meteorologist Jeff Masters. He's ridden government research planes into the eye of a hurricane, and no doubt he's driven some back roads looking for twisters. And now Jeff writes about big weather developments in the blog, The Weather Underground, at wonderground.com. And what else do you do, Jeff? Do you provide weather forecasting services?
Personally, I don't do that anymore. I mean, are you talking about my company or myself?
I'd like to know about your company.
We provide a webpage that has, just for free, basically weather information for the world. You type in a location and get a forecast. We also have a network of personal weather stations. These are backyard sorts of weather stations that are over 200,000, I think, now. So we have just an unprecedented granularity to our weather that you can get. So not just forecasts, you can get these observations from personal weather stations all over the world. In fact, we've generate weather forecasts for those weather stations too. We also have a huge community that's very involved in participating in observing the weather and talking about it. My blog comments frequently run to several thousand per day. This kind of an online forum where people talk about the weather. We have 1.9 million user uploaded photos of weather that people have uploaded to share. Anybody who wants to can start their own blog to talk about the weather. We've got several hundred bloggers who write regularly about the weather on our website. And we've got a huge network of weather webcams as well. So it's just a giant hotbed of everything weather on our website. And I kind of anchor it by giving my daily commentary on what's going on in the world. And my main passion is for hurricanes. So this time of year, I start getting cranked up to talk about them. But during the rest of the year, and I'll talk about tornadoes and tornado season and winter storm season.
And that's all at wonderground.com. Thank you so much, Jeff Masters, for your time and for your passion about all this.
All right, Alex, you're welcome.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. As Jeff Master says, this paper by James Hansen et al. Is looking at extremes. Unfortunately, while the extreme case may not happen, we may very well get faster and higher sea level rise, accompanied by superstorms, as Hansen says. A number of influential scientists do not yet agree with the claims launched in this paper. It isn't settled, but it is unsettling. If you search the net or look at publicly available chains of reviewer comments, it appears Hansen is at the bleeding edge and not the core of the current climate research community. I invited some scientists critical of this paper to speak on Radio EcoShock. For example, Dr. Michael Mann, who has appeared on the show before, bowed out due to a load of academic work he has right at this time. I contacted Dr. Kevin Trenberth. He's the Distinguished Senior Scientist in the Climate Analysis Section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. Trenberth has been a lead author in at least two reports of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He's an acknowledged world expert on some of the issues raised in this paper by Hansen et al. While Dr. Trenberth decided not to do a live interview on this paper, he did send me his considered comments, and he agreed I could read them out to you on Radio EcoShock. Here is what Trenberth says about the paper, Ice Melt, Sea Level Rise, and Superstorms. The new Hansen et al. Study is provocative and intriguing, but rife with speculation and what-if scenarios. It has many conjectures and huge extrapolations based on quite flimsy evidence, but evidence nonetheless. In that regard, it raises good questions and topics worthy of further exploration, but it is not a document that can be used for setting policy for anthropogenic climate change, although it pretends to be so. The paper is long. It hinges upon interpretation of paleo and other data that is apt to be somewhat controversial. It uses a model that is a coarse resolution and which does not have very good climate simulation. The evaluation model leaves much to be desired. No differences are shown compared with observations, and some errors are large. No mention is made of ENSO or Pacific Decadal Variations that dominate interannual and decadal variability in the real world, and which are a key to understanding the recent hiatus and recent trends that are not representative of longer-term trends, although frequently interpreted as such. In Section 3.8.5, the authors point out the need to simulate a number of features realistically, and the model does not really do them very well, especially basic things like sea surface salinity. So the relevance of the model is not established. They use the model for a number of highly artificial experiments that are supposed to depict melting of ice at high latitudes, fresh water injection. These experiments introduce a lot of very cold fresh water in various places, and then they see what happens. The question is how relevant these are to the real world, and what is happening as global warming progresses. They do not seem at all realistic to me. A key to a lot of this is how clouds change, and one needs to get clouds right in the first place to have confidence in the results. Unfortunately, this is an area where major problems exist. Huge problems occur over the southern oceans, for instance, and all models have far too much sunshine penetrating to the surface. compared with observations. No doubt the Southern Ocean, featured strongly by Hansen et al., plays an important role, but data, these are poor, and change is not well known. In particular, the recent hiatus in global warming greatly influences any observations, which can therefore be quite misleading when it comes to long-term trends. I certainly do not believe the result claimed with regard to less snow over Antarctica with a warming climate, although Hansen argues that the real world is responding even faster than in the model scenarios. This is not at all clear, owing to the natural variability. The paper is quite well written, and a tour de force in many respects, but there are way too many assumptions and extrapolations for anything here to be taken seriously other than to promote further studies. The authors often say that these model limitations must be kept in mind, and there are many other model limitations not discussed, but then they do not keep them in mind when drawing conclusions. Some of the conclusions with regard to the need for immediate actions I strongly agree with, but it seems that this study has gone out of its way to make the case, stretching credibility. Kevin Trenberth. Those were comments from Dr. Kevin Trenberth. He's the senior scientist at the Climate Analysis Section at the U.S. Government National Center for Atmospheric Research, so he certainly knows a lot about this subject. So what do I think? I'm not sure it matters, as I'm not a climate scientist, a politician, or an expert. Still, from the hundreds of scientists that I have interviewed over the past 10 years, and my research and watching climate events over the past 25 years, I will offer a few tentative things. First, as a science journalist, it seems to me we're always playing catch-up with reality. The science, particularly projections by the IPCC, always seem at least a decade behind what actually happens. Jim Hansen says the models are not sufficient. He presents one way he thinks they are broken. The group appears to say we need a new set of assumptions to get where the climate is really going, but they are assumptions, and that's dangerous for science. I have followed James Hansen's career since the early 1990s. He tends to ask extreme questions in order to test them. For example, he published a paper investigating whether Earth could lose its atmosphere due to runaway climate change, or are there natural breaks? Hansen found we won't lose the atmosphere, but he asked the question, likely due to his early work on the atmosphere of Venus and Mars is a planet which may have lost its atmosphere, so he is looking at extreme edges. I am least certain about the work on superstorms, a subject which seems to worry and fascinate James Hansen. His first book was Storms of My Grandchildren. He's working on a second. He may be right in the long run, but I have not seen a train of evidence to suggest off-the-charts monster storms will be seen this century, much less before 2050. Likewise, the projection that the North Atlantic ocean currents could be overturned this century due to ice melt runs against the scientific work I've seen so far on that subject, and I thought that was laid to rest, at least for the short term. I applaud the Hansen team promoting a more open platform for publishing, where other scientists and the interested public can see the questions and answers that shape the development of science. These topics are too important to wait a year or two in the dark in the previous publication process. On the other hand, I think review by one's peers, and in this case it would take the world's top scientists, remains essential to keep close to fact and truth. In my view, James Hansen and his group became frustrated with science that was unable to keep up with rapid climate change. They challenged the world to do better, and they challenged the political system to realize there are unacceptable risks to all this. This isn't a game. We probably won't know how right or wrong this paper is until 2030, if not 2050. By then, of course, we will be utterly committed to Earth with a very different climate. We just don't know how different or how fast we will get there. I invited Dr. Hansen to speak on this program. He agreed to a day and time last week, but then at the very last minute excused himself to attend another appointment. He has not responded to my requests to reschedule. I find this unprofessional, but I don't know the stress and the workload he bears. I'm sorry to miss his input. I'll get more reaction to this paper on ice melt, superstorms, and sea level rise as it comes in. Other scientists and activists have agreed to talk about this. I'll be putting a ton of links for you to follow up in my weekly show blog this week at ecoshock.info. Please check that out. You can find the original paper, the comments of the reviewers, essential news articles about it, and a lot more, and that's published Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Now we move to one of the biggest current impacts of climate change on this planet, and that's saying something. As I struggle to cover world problems, comes a call from Vivian Langford. She's the host of Beyond Zero on 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia. You must cover the mass bleaching of coral in the Great Barrier Reef, she said. And Vivian sent me a link to a powerful story by David Spratt. He's the author of the book Climate Code Red and one of my favorite blogs, which is also called Climate Code Red. And David asks, after the record, mind-numbing coral bleaching, what would it take to save the reef? Good question. David Spratt, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. Lovely to be with you.
Okay, now, as you write in your blog, back in 2009, Charlie Veron, one of the world's greatest coral experts, told the Royal Society the Great Barrier Reef was on a death watch, as he put it, and that was then. But let's back up a little bit, David. We've all seen video of gorgeous coral, but it's hard for us to grasp the size of Australia's giant reef. How would you describe it?
Well, I mean, this long before we had World Heritage listings, I mean, this was often listed as one of the seven great wonders of the natural world, together with Mount Everest, the Antarctic Victoria Falls, and so on. So this is a magnificent thing that stretches almost 3,000 kilometres down the east coast of Australia. This is something that you can see from outer space, literally, in its size. There's no other coral structure like it in the world. It's the most precious ecosystem we have in Australia.
Yes, and I know it's mind-boggling, the amount of living things that depend on it, but could you talk to us a little bit about the biological importance of this Great Barrier Reef?
Well, look, barrier reefs have actually, coral structures have been around for 500 million years. I mean, they're really old. Corals have produced more fossils than anything else in this world. A quarter of all marine species live in and around coral systems. And around the world, particularly in Asia, but in other places as well, there are tens of millions of people who depend on coral reefs, and because they're very rich environments, particularly for people who use marine protein as their primary form of protein, they're absolutely essential for many people in the developing world for their day-to-day survival. So from so many perspectives, they are just so essential.
And could you explain what gives the coral those brilliant colours we've seen, and then why it can go white?
Coral, I guess to many of us, has two meanings. One is those big limestone structures we see. So the coral animal, the coral polyp, is like a small jellyfish, and it builds a base of limestone, of calcium carbonate, in which it situates itself and builds structures. So you've got an inert limestone base and an animal that lives on the top layer of it. That coral polyp lives in a symbiotic relationship with a very small algae called zooxanthella. And that algae and the coral polyp, the coral animal, are codependent because the algae produces the oxygen that the polyp needs and the polyp produces the carbon dioxide that the algae needs. So they have to go together. And it's the algae that actually give coral those many bright colours we see. If the temperature, the water temperature, gets too hot, the polyps get stressed and they expel the algae. And if they expel all the algae, and once they're expelled, they do not come back. So if you have what's called, and this is why we have the word bleaching, because if a coral polyp expel the algae, the coral loses its colour and goes that almost translucent white colour, so hence the notion of bleaching. So you can have bleaching which is not so severe, where some of the algae will be expelled or some of the corals in a reef system will expel their algae, but not all of them. In a severe bleaching, what we've seen this time, the corals literally die because they are starved of food and nutrients, and that's what we're seeing in an unprecedented way on the most pristine section of the barrier reef at the moment.
And how much of that Great Barrier Reef has bleached white this year?
Well, there are are about 3,000 reef systems in the Great Barrier Reef, stretching over 3,000 kilometres. Scientists over the last month, 6 weeks, have done a survey, both an aerial survey and getting into the water, where they spent a lot of time, and they assessed 910 reefs, and of them they found 500 to be what they called severely bleached, which means that their prognosis is not good. In particular, the northernmost 1,000 kilometres of the reef, which stretches from northern Queensland through the Coral Sea up almost to New Guinea, is the most pristine, the most touched, the highest value section of the reef. In that section, the northern section, they found that more than 50% mortality of corals already. Now, it must be understood that when they go back in 2 or 3 months, that mortality rate will be up. They think it will be around 90% on some of the reefs. So we, and really sadly, are looking at perhaps most, certainly most, three quarters more even of the best 1,000 kilometres of the Barrier Reef just having died from climate change, from record hot waters in the Coral Sea this Australian summer.
Yes, when masses of coral first turned white in the 1980s, people thought it was a disease. How do we know, David Spratt, that it's really a signal of climate change?
The fact is, there hadn't been a bleaching event until the 1980s. So this is a new phenomenon, and bleaching can be reproduced in the laboratory. I mean, a lot of work has been done on the Barrier Reef. It's an essential part of Australia's identity, of its natural ecosystems. It also supports 80,000 people in terms of the tourist industry. It's one of Australia's best-known icons. So a lot of work's been done. And you can, in a laboratory situation, take waters with corals in them and warm them up and watch this process happening. You can also increase the amount of carbon dioxide in the water, which is another consequence of climate change. As we put more into the air, about 40% of that carbon dioxide is drawn down into the water, mixes with H2O to produce carbonic acid, which is a weak acid, and that acid itself will eat away at limestone structures, whether they be corals or the shells of hard animals like crabs and so on. And they produce this in the laboratory, so this is now a well-known and well-observed event.
And have the seas around Australia been hotter than normal?
Yes, we've just had particularly the section which is most badly bleached had the hottest waters on record, literally without exception, about 1 degree warmer than the average over the last 20 years. That is partly a consequence of the El Nino. As we know, in the El Nino, you get a very large blob of warm water in the eastern Pacific. As the El Nino starts to moderate, as is happening at the moment, the normal trade winds resume and that warm water gets moved westward. So 6 months ago, some of the coral scientists were saying, you know, we've got a bad feeling. We can see this really large, warm mass of water, which we think is probably heading towards Australia, and that's what's happened.
So, as you said, coral's been around for about 500 million years. It has faced mass extinction events before, and somehow it recovered. David, why are marine scientists so worried about the bleaching this year?
Well, what we have to understand is that if a coral is killed by a bleaching event, that is, it loses all its algae, the limestone structure remains, but the polyps, the animals inside, die. And then the only way that coral reef can be rebuilt is for new coral larva to settle on the old structure and start the building process again. So downstream from the existing reef, a new reef can be formed, and that's how coral spreads. Charlie Veron, who I quote in the article, I mean, literally the godfather of coral science, a man who has identified and named a third of the world's corals, told me that it takes about 15 years after a bleaching event for the coral, as he said it, to look good again, for a bleached reef to be recolonized with new coral. If, in a global warming world, you have these warmer seas more and more often, you're going to get bleaching events at shorter and shorter intervals, so you just don't get that 10 to 15 years for recovery. So it's really a death spiral of bleaching events at shorter and shorter intervals. And some scientists at the University of Melbourne, led by Professor David Caroli, just did some work around some models and said this event of warm waters we had this year, which was extraordinary, they said, in 20 years' time, by 2034, we believe that these sort of water temperatures around the reef will happen once every 2 years. And that's a death sentence for coral reefs in terms of the incapacity to rebuild before they get whacked again. It's like sort of, you know, getting hit and standing up and getting hit again. It's just a terrible sequence of events. And so what we have come to understand now, that at global average warming is now about 1 degree around the world, at 1 degree, coral systems will not survive.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, David Spratt. He's the author of the book and blog Climate Code Red, and the latest climate emergency is for coral in Australia's Great Barrier Reef.
So I think we should also say that, of course, these bleaching events are not confined to Australia. They're happening right around the world in different places, depending on the particular sea temperatures. So my recent study has been at the Great Barrier Reef, but this is a story that can be told in many places, from the Middle East to the Caribbean and right through Asia.
Right. It is a global story, and I wish we had time to cover it, and I'm hoping to get there eventually. So getting back to Australia's case, though, is part of the Great Barrier Reef already dead?
Coral reefs have been under the hammer for a long time. So a study was done a few years ago, and they established that the extent, literally the footprint of the Great Barrier Reef, is about half of what it was 30 or 35 years ago. That is due to a number of factors. There was a large bleaching event in 1998 associated with the previous El Nino. Because we've had 15 years, most of the corals have come back. So about 10% of the loss of the barrier reef extent is due to bleaching. There are obviously a number of other problems that coral reefs have in Australia. We have a terrible thing called the crown of thorn starfish, which has literally been chewing it up. We also have a problem that the barrier reef is just off the Queensland coast, where there's a lot of agriculture, particularly sugarcane, and a lot of the fertilizers run off the land and into the ocean, and they also have a terrible effect by fertilizing predators. We're also having more intense cyclones and the commotion on the surface of the water can physically destroy reefs as well. So reefs are under the hammer from a number of sources, but this event of monumental destruction is directly a climate change-related one.
And what happens to a reef once the actual coral animals are gone?
Well, we've got three possibilities. If the reef is only partially bleached, that is, there are some algae remaining in the coral, then those corals will recover, and that happens. If all the algae is recovered, is expelled from a coral, two things can happen. With enough time, new larvae can come and settle on it and rebuild it, but the coral structure can also become diseased, and it just starts to break up, and in the end you get what I would, in a very unscientific way, called a green slime that just builds over the coral, and over a period of years to decades, the limestone structure itself will just break down and look, you know, like the remnants of a collapsed building scattered across the floor of the ocean.
I've heard it described as rubble.
Rubble, indeed.
Well, so far, as you know, this year 2016 has broken global heat records, not by a little bit, but by a lot. And how close are we to the upper limits where coral can survive around Australia?
Well, we've now had, at 1 degree of global average warming, an extraordinary event where the sea surface temperatures were a degree hotter than normal. The last event, as I said, was the largest, biggest bleaching between 1998 and 2002, so we've had 10 years. The corals recovered. If we stayed at this 1 degree of global warming, I mean, it may be 5 years before another hot water event. It may be 15. I mean, the coral might struggle on to some extent at 1 degree of warming. But if we get another half a degree of warming, and there was a very important peer-reviewed piece of research done, which said that if you got the global average temperatures of 1.5 degrees, and that's what we're looking at in, you know, perhaps the next 20 years, another half degree of warming, then their estimate was that coral reefs would be reduced to less than 10% of their present area. They would be remnant systems. They wouldn't be something that we would call part of a Great Barrier Reef. It would be a tiny barrier reef. So another half degree of warming, which is sort of in the system now, and they'll be gone. If we stayed at the current temperature, they'd struggle on better and not so well.
Let's get to the human role. Since Australia counts on billions of dollars in tourist revenue and other kinds of revenue, as you talked about, from this famous reef system, I assume the government is focused on saving them, are they?
The barrier reef tourist operators are in a difficult position. As I mentioned before, there's about 80,000 people, $8 to $10 billion a year of economic activity generated off the reef. The tourist operators don't want to scare away the visitors, so they're saying that there are parts of the reef which you can still visit, which is true. They must also know that their long-term business plan is that they won't have a business. So they're caught in a contradiction. The Australian government has played a terrible role. We have an environment minister who keeps on saying he wants to save the reef and then gives planning permission, environmental permission for huge new coal mines to be opened. So objectively, the Australian government is aiding and abetting the destruction of the Great Barrier Reef.
Well, we're kind of like that in Canada. We talk about the environment and then we promote the tar sands. We've just had a big fire near the tar sands and the Canadian Prime Minister came out and said, well, we'll rebuild right away. I could go on and on, but I won't.
No. And I'm sure people who draw a connection between as we have in Australia, between extraordinary outer season or extreme bushfires and climate change, and they want to shoot the messenger for suggesting what is obviously and scientifically able to be demonstrated.
Yes, I put out a little YouTube about it and got some terrible comments, but that's just part of the game. Now, I have to think, though, that when I hear Australian politicians, both federal and state, promising to expand coal mining, coal ports, more coal exports, they must somehow think the Great Barrier Reef is expendable, a kind of collateral damage. What do you think is going on in their minds?
Look, that's a good question. I think that in Australia, which is the two important things about Australia, we have the highest greenhouse emissions per capita of any developed country in the world. So we are really profligate. We have really large fossil fuel export capacity, which is trying to be built. Unfortunately, the collapsing coal demand and coal prices has stopped, at least the time being, a whole lot of new coal mines being built, particularly inland from the Barrier Reef. But these are people who have seen fossil fuels as a cargo cult and cannot understand that the continued operation of the fossil fuel industry and having a planet that livable are simply contradictory propositions. And it has to be said that, in my experience and the experience of others, most of these politicians and their advisors are very poorly informed on the science. Maybe that's deliberate, but in a basic, scientific, emotional, existential way, they simply don't get it.
But I know that there are millions of Australians who are deeply concerned about the Great Barrier Reef as it fights for its life. Who are the voices in the groups struggling to save the Great Reef?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question about whether and how the Great Barrier Reef could be saved now. I mean, the simple proposition is that at 1 degree of global warming, the reef's in severe trouble. With more warming, it's certainly going to be in a death spiral. So to say something like the Barrier Reef actually means having a conversation and trying to think about whether we can stop physical global warming getting any worse than it is now, because if it is, the reef will be gone. If we can hold global warming at 1 degree and knock it down a bit by large amounts of carbon drawdown and so on, then maybe it's got a hope. That's a very difficult conversation, I think, for a lot of climate groups and activists to have. Certainly, over the last 3 or 4 years in Australia, a lot of work has been done to draw the connections between the proposals for new coal mines on the Queensland coast near the Barrier Reef and the future of the reef. But in fact, the reef is being killed not by future coal mines, but by the coal mines and the oil that's been extracted over the last 20 or 30 years. So lots of campaigning and honestly, a lot of deep heartfelt concern and pain about what people have seen.
I'm feeling it myself. Have you seen some action in the international arena about pressuring Australia or trying to help Australia to save this reef?
Well, yes. Some of my friends in North America have pointed out to me that there are climate campaigning organisations in the United States and Canada who have actually been directing their members to get into contact with their politicians and also Australian politicians in Australia. So I think there's been quite a bit of solidarity in terms of this issue, as indeed there needs to be.
And if we lose this battle, and we may, how fast might it go dark and dead?
Well, I think it's a death spiral. I mean, the bleaching wasn't even, it was worse on the north than the south. A lot of the southern areas are not in such bad shape, so they will battle on. Maybe the next surge of hot water will hit a different part of the reef, so there won't be a moment when the lights will go out. But just the extent, the footprint of the reef, its connectedness will suffer. So it will be death by a thousand small warmings, I'm afraid. Certainly in coral scientists really honestly say, they've said, if you want a safe reef, bleaching started at around 320 to 340 parts per million of carbon dioxide. I mean, that was 30, 40 years in the past. We're now at 400 parts per million. When we got to 387 parts per million almost 10 years ago, they said, we're now past the point where the reef can survive. So that's some context that it is now our past emissions and sins which are dreadfully catching up with us.
Right, and there's about a 30-year delay, I've heard.
That's right.
From what we already burned is still to come.
That's right. I mean, we saw another example of that a couple of years ago when that really important research came out on some of the West Antarctic glaciers, and they said, we can now see that some of these glaciers have passed their tipping points for total loss of the glacier, of increasing glaciation, and that will lead to 1 or 2 metres off the immediate glaciers, but this will trigger glaciation of much more of West Antarctic, which is 3 to 5 metres of sea level rise. And we asked some of the scientists who've been involved in that work, so when do you think the tipping point was, and at what level of carbon dioxide do you think this event happened? And they said, look, you've got to go back to the 1970s. You'd have to go back to 1970s levels of carbon dioxide probably to stop those West Antarctic ice sheets tipping over. So as with the Barrier Reef and so many other things, we don't see these tipping points coming because by their nature, in a way, we can't. But when they do occur, what we're seeing is things that were put in train decades before, and that's the whole story of global warming and its delayed consequences.
We almost see it in the rearview mirror.
Yes, unfortunately, unless we can turn the car or the truck or the bus or the tram around very quickly.
So you published Climate Code Red in 2008. Are you considering a new edition of the book, another book, or is that your blog?
That's my blog now. I think things are changing so quickly that when we wrote that book, somebody said we were pretty adventurous. Some people would have called us alarmist back then. But in fact, that book has stood the test of time better than most, in that most of the things it talked about, we talked in that book back in 2007-8 of the West Antarctic ice sheet probably having passed its tipping point when very few other people did. So it's still relevant in a way, but I think the pace of change is now so great that you're always playing catch-up, as indeed some of the climate science is. I mean, the noticeable thing about the last year and the El Nino and the extraordinary events that have happened in Alberta, in the Great Barrier Reef, the extraordinary droughts in Asia, in the water shortages in India, the food problems in southern Africa, is that the observations, what's actually happening on the ground, often seem in advance of what we thought or projected would happen. And that's been the story of global warming over the last 20 years. I remember when we did our book and there'd been that incredible ice mass loss, sea ice mass loss in the northern summer of 2007 in the Arctic. And one of the climate scientists said, but this is happening 100 years ahead of schedule. And in fact, the laws of physics don't wait for our schedules. They proceed as they must. And this is one of the problems, that the risks associated with climate change and what will happen, I think, are often been underestimated in the public conversation, unless you really take a lot of time and effort, as you have in your program, and we've talked about this before, to really get to grips with all the risks and all the possibilities. And public policymakers have tended to veer to the other side of the road and in a way try to downplay the risk, I think.
From Melbourne, Australia, we've been talking with David Spratt. He's the author, blogger, and activist, and chronicler of the age of climate change, I think. You can find links for this interview in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. You can follow David Spratt at climatecodered.org, and on Twitter his handle is at DJ Spratt. David, thank you for all your work for the climate and for talking with us today.
It's a great pleasure, Alex. Thank you so much.
That's it for this week. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening.
An ad for bus driver.
That's right.
And you were frankly desperate.
Frankly desperate is absolutely what I was. I was within probably, I don't want to eyeball it too carefully, but I was pretty close to going on default on my mortgage. And I needed money. I needed work. And I was trying to look for work, I think, that would allow me still to be a writer. You know, that was ideal. If it wasn't part-time, if it was full-time, it was, like, a bus driver was perfect because I would get up, as I assumed it, drive, like, some rowdy bus full of high schoolers to school. They'd all barrel out. I'd go home and do my writing. I'd come back, pick them up, drop them off, and thus my life could go apace, and I could continue to try to pursue this folly of being a writer. And it did kind of go that way, but I ended up driving a very a small bus for children with special needs. And it was a much smaller, only five of them. So we ended up, forming friendships and getting to know each other in a way that I was not expecting, and maybe they weren't expecting either.
I felt like I knew these kids, you know?
That's great. That's very heartening to hear, Craig. Each one of them was mesmerizing, and I think that allowed me to capture them as best as I could, is because they're so honest and so frank and so... heartfelt, and sometimes, I mean, they just have an openness of character.
Take me through the kids. Can we start with Gavin and kind of
sure, yeah.
Work from there?
Gavin, who is this wonderful blonde-haired boy who was probably 12 or 13 the year that I drove him, and he has, for the longest time, I thought he had autism. But in fact, he has Fragile X syndrome, a little bit of autism as well. I mean, a lot of times with conditions, it's not a distinctive thing. There's sort of variations within it. But it actually took his parents letting me know that, because on the route assignment sheet, it had that he had autism. And he was pretty much nonverbal, but again, manages to have a very distinct, obvious, lovely personality. Despite the fact that he doesn't communicate with words at all. He communicates more with gestures and, almost a form of sign language, you know. And then we had Oliver, and Oliver was like the live wire of the bus. You know, again, 13, grade 7 or grade 8 at the time that I drove him. Just a compelling storyteller,
A tall tale teller.
That's right. As I said, he's almost really a fibber, really a liar, actually. But his lies were told with such panache, as I think I write, that you just had to let him go on these, flights of fancy. And he was the one that would get us rolling in the aisles most often. And then we had Nadja, who is the lone female rider, and was East Indian and lived with her family in a condo in the south end of Calgary, and loved the things that young girls love, which is almost stereotypically princesses and unicorns and Hannah Montana and West Side Story, and she had her own drama.
Everybody in her family died at one point.
That's right.
I don't think anybody. I'm guessing that no one actually.
No,
died.
Nobody did, as far as I could tell. She again. They were all kind of tall tale tellers, and she would have every day. It seemed like she'd have gone to some sort of dinner party, but it ended in some sort of terrible calamity with somebody dying or a girder falling from the ceiling and hitting them all. And then you realized after a while, no, she's just. At first, you're like, oh, my God, Nadja, that is awful. And then after a while, you realize, you're fibbing. You're pulling my leg here. So, And then we had, who else do we have? Oh, we had Vincent, who was a big guy with the pop culture recollection of, you know, a dictionary, was into all sorts of obscure kind of pop culture phenomenon, was a storyteller himself. They were all storytellers. And he was the oldest boy on the bus, and but the most gentle probably of all of them. He was like a gentle giant. And then I guess most prominently we had Jake, who had whose condition was cerebral palsy, and we met under you know, if my life was a little fraught, his life was really fraught. He about 4 months before I started driving the bus, he lost his mother to a drunk driving accident.
He got hit too.
Yeah, him and a family friend and his mother and his sister were out for a walk in their residential area, and a drunk driver just barreled down in a giant truck and hit them and killed his mother. And he was in a medical coma for a couple weeks. And so this was kind of the environment in which we first came into contact, you know. And that became a very special friendship between the two of us. And we were the two that hung out outside of the bus and, you know, go to movies and go to dinner and lunch and just hang out at his house, watch movies or play board games. And that probably, without Jake, there would be no book. I think all the other kids are wonderful and fun and lovely and loving and compelling, but the one relationship that made me want to write the book and said that I had to write the book was the relationship between Jake and I.
I've only met the post Precious Cargo you.
Right, right.
Who I like a lot.
Oh, well, I appreciate that.
I don't think maybe I would have liked the other guy.
No. No, I don't think I liked myself. And, you know, you're right. It's interesting to go back and kind of in edits to read about my old self to a degree. Not that you really ever do. It's not like you're a snake that you molt your old self. That old self is still there somewhere, and I guess that is somewhat the fear, is that you know, you're never shed of your old ways necessarily. So, but you can remember what they were and try and be better than them.
The book is Precious Cargo. I've been speaking with the author Craig Davidson, and Precious Cargo, My Year Driving the Kids on School Bus 3077 is published by Knopf Canada. Surprised to see that you admit that Occupy failed.
Yeah.
You, in fact, think that failing was a success.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what you just said is so perceptive, and I really appreciate that, because I was just talking to someone, and they also fixated on this thing about, was Occupy a failure? And she couldn't accept that argument. She's like, no, it was a success. It was a success. And I think that, you know, among contemporary activists, there's this narrative, which is that there's no such thing as failure, that everything we're doing is somehow, it's like a positive narrative we tell ourselves, that Occupy didn't fail, it just splintered to 1,000 shards of light and all this kind of stuff. But I think that the problem with that narrative is that it ultimately stops us from understanding why we did not achieve the social change that we wanted. And that's why I call Occupy Wall Street a constructive failure. It wasn't a total failure. It didn't achieve nothing at all, but it didn't achieve what we set out to achieve. It achieved secondary things, like it raised awareness, it trained a new generation of activists, it made protesting cool again. So that's why I call it a constructive failure. And the core idea there is that it taught us about the limitations of our current notions of activism. And that's why I wrote my book, is to kind of help activists up our game and become more sophisticated in the way we think about activism. One of the challenges, I think, of activists right now is that we're largely very unsophisticated about the way we think about social change. We basically have one model, and it's get as many people as possible into the streets, unified behind a single demand, and, you know, doing nonviolent actions together. Like, that's basically the paradigm. And we achieved that with Occupy, and it didn't work. And so we need to rethink our paradigm, and that's what I'm trying to get at.
Make an interesting comparison between that, the sort of, this is our current paradigm of how to protest, with the barricades in France.
Mm. I think protest is basically a form of warfare. It's a form of politics by other means, which is kind of like a definition of war. It doesn't mean it's always violent, but instead what it means is that you're using unconventional means to influence the political regime. And what that means, though, is that your opponent learns very quickly from your new behaviors. And so activism is actually a domain in which you have to innovate constantly. So if you look at the example of the barricades in 1848, I think this is a perfect example for activists to look at and study, which is that they first erected barricades in, you know, in Paris in like basically like February or something like that. And it was so effective, it toppled the king. They got all these like amazing laws passed, like, you know, universal like employment and all this kind of great stuff. And then very quickly, the barricades spread all over Europe. And all of the great revolutionaries of the time, Marx, Engels, Bakunin, they were alive, they were witnessing this, and they thought, this is it. This is the revolutionary moment we've been dreaming of. It was much like Occupy in that sense, that we all kind of, like, believed. But then the barricades were smashed, and they were smashed by a French general who for the very first time, used cannon fire to destroy the barricades. And once they figured out how to do that, then all of the barricades across Europe were smashed within, you know, a couple weeks. And furthermore, whenever barricades were used again, such as like during the Paris Commune in 1871, or even during like the Russian Revolution in 1905 and all this kind of stuff, they were also smashed. And we haven't seen barricades ever be effective again, because now they know how to defeat barricade. And it's the same thing with Occupy. Occupy was extremely effective, the tactic of occupying public space, holding a general assembly, very effective for about 60 days. But once the Zuccotti encampment was evicted, you can go back in time and you can look and you see that almost all the encampments around the world were evicted within 1 week, because they all learned the same way, to the same countermeasure. And so as activists, it's beholden on us to understand that our opponent is slow to react, but very good at replicating its solution to the problem, basically. It can disseminate its counter tactic extremely quickly. And it's effective because it trains. You know, even right now, there's probably police officers who are training in how to defeat an Occupy-type event, you know? And so activism requires a level of innovation that is very difficult to achieve. But otherwise, what you fall into is what I call the end of protest, which is the proliferation of ineffective protest. The revolution always looks differently. The French Revolution did not look like the Russian Revolution, and the next revolution won't look like the Russian Revolution. The next great movement, social movement, won't look like Occupy Wall Street. And so, it's good to learn about those things, but it's also good to, like, really stay open. It's one of the hard things.
If for some reason lightning strikes twice and you're at the vanguard of another revolution, what are you personally learned and put it in your toolkit?
Yeah, I mean, I believe absolutely lightning is going to strike again, and I will be involved in another great social movement. Based on my own experience as an activist, it always comes again for me. I do think that on the one hand, you have to realize that any sort of urban protest can't last very long. Like, I think maybe 28 days at the most for an urban protest. And on the other hand, I think that you have to kind of aggressively go for the like jugular, as it were, which is basically you have to aggressively go for power while you have the opportunity.
I'm now going to declare you the most dangerous man in America.
Wow, thank you.
Because you're thinking about it, and you know, you're smart, and you're waiting for your moment.
I'm extremely patient, of course. You have to be so patient and so confident and so strategic. Yeah, absolutely. I would love to be the most dangerous man in America, but we'll have to. I mean, I think in a certain sense, you know, when you start to compare yourself to actual successful revolutionaries of the past, then you kind of like have to be a little bit more humble and say, let's just see what actually happens. Let's see what I actually can do, because Occupy was nothing compared to like the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution or the Cuban Revolution or Chinese Revolution, any of these revolutions. You know, it was just a foretaste, maybe, or a foreshock.
The book is The End of Protest, A New Playbook for Revolution. I've been speaking with the most dangerous man in America, Micah White, and The End of Protest is published by Knopf Canada.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present law professor and author Ian Haney Lopez, who examines the presumptive Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump's blatant appeal to racism and the opportunities to build support for a progressive economic agenda. Maxine McCleary, a leader with the community group Action United, who talks about growing opposition to the proposed expansion of Philadelphia Energy Solutions' fossil fuel refinery in her South Philly neighborhood. And Alberto Saldamondo of the Indigenous Environmental Network, who discusses his recent trip to Honduras, where he and other activists met with U.S. officials to demand an independent investigation into the murder of Indigenous and environmental rights leader Berta Cáceres. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Scientists in Brazil are worried that the Zika virus is more dangerous than previously thought as a cause of birth defects in young children. Already, the Zika outbreak, which began in Brazil and spread to over more than 50 countries, has been linked to microcephaly, a condition where babies are born with abnormally small heads. Medical researchers in the South American country told the BBC that 20% of Zika-infected pregnancies could result in various forms of brain damage to infants. Health officials have detected cerebral calcifications and other abnormalities in infant brains. In a positive development, researchers have discovered that the spread of the Zika virus can be slowed by injecting a common bacteria into mosquitoes that transmit the virus. The Zika virus has been found across the United States, usually carried by people who had visited Latin America. An elderly man in Puerto Rico recently died from complications after being infected by the virus. The Obama administration has sought $1.9 billion to battle the disease, but so far has been blocked by the Republican-controlled Congress. The Centers for Disease Control has warned that many southern states are not prepared to deal with local Zika outbreaks. General Electric is moving its corporate headquarters from suburban Fairfield, Connecticut, to Boston, with the enticement of $25 million in city property tax concessions and $250 million in other subsidies. According to the American Prospect, Boston's optimism for a big payback from GE's move may be ill-founded. Other cities and states have been burned by entering into corporate tax break deals and have been reluctant to use clawback provisions to force the reimbursement of taxpayer subsidies when things go wrong. The Commonwealth of Massachusetts lost out when Evergreen Solar, a solar panel manufacturer, went bankrupt in 2011. The state could only reclaim a percentage of its multimillion-dollar investment, and 800 people were thrown out of work. The advocacy group Good Jobs First found that even states that had strong clawback provisions, like Vermont and North Carolina, are reluctant to reclaim subsidies when corporations did not meet job targets out of fear of being branded anti-business. Some cities are now embracing performance-based incentives, where subsidies are not granted until targets such as job creation are met. There are tens of thousands of urban residents experiencing what's become known as the middle-class squeeze in fashionable cities like San Francisco, Seattle, and Boston, urban centers that have attracted tech-savvy millennials seeking the good life. Public sector workers, such as teachers and police officers, face a shortage of affordable housing since rents have skyrocketed, and they're not eligible for government subsidies to help cover their rent. Many desirable cities, including Seattle and New York, have seen rising inequality as middle-class residents flee, creating a new barbell economy with disproportionate numbers of rich and poor. The average house in San Francisco now sells for over $765,000, 10 times the city's average median income. In Boston, it's difficult for many city employees to lease an apartment, which requires 2 months' rent and a security deposit. As a possible remedy, Boston Mayor Martin Walsh has promised to create 53,000 new housing units by 2030. The city has also made a commitment to preserve affordable housing through a partnership with Local 888 of the Service Employees International Union. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Billionaire real estate developer Donald Trump, now the presumptive Republican Party presidential candidate, has, since he launched his campaign, consistently employed racist, xenophobic, and misogynist rhetoric to fire up a base made up mostly of white middle-aged men. He's attacked Mexicans as rapists and murderers, advocated a ban on all Muslims entering the U.S., and insulted women based on sexist stereotypes. As a result, Trump will be entering the general election campaign with highly unfavorable views among many different constituency groups. He has a 70% unfavorable image among women, 86% from black voters, and 75% from Latinos, according to recent polls. Your reporter spoke with Ian Haney Lopez, John H. Bull Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of the book Dog Whistle Politics: How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Here, Professor Lopez examines the role racial prejudice and economic insecurity has played in drawing supporters to Trump's campaign and the opportunities in the 2016 election to build support for a progressive economic agenda.
We are not saying that all of Trump's supporters are racist in that sort of hate every black person, put on a robe and burn a cross sort of way, which is not to say that they're not out there. I mean, this is a candidate who has attracted endorsements from former Klan wizard David Duke and other white nationalists. So, yeah, there are some of the people who rallied behind Trump who are these out-and-out, you know, malicious, bigoted, racist types. But that's not what we're talking about. For the most part, what we're talking about is a sort of pervasive racial fear that has that predominates among a significant segment of the white population, and it is a race through which they see the society and through which they see politics and the economy. And these are the people that Trump is speaking to. And what's important to realize is that this isn't Trump tapping into some sort of subterranean fears that nobody knew was there. This is instead Trump taking advantage of groundwork that has been laid by the Republican Party for the last 50 years. And so here I want to pause and just give some really startling numbers. Who are the GOP supporters today? They draw roughly 93-94% of their support from white voters, and 98% of their elected officials are white. This is a party that for the last 50 years has constituted itself around a racial narrative that says to Americans, the biggest threat in your lives comes from other poor people of color. It comes from the liberal institutions like unions and like government that support poor people of color. Worry about them. Hate government. Trust instead the big corporations and the very rich. That's the basic narrative that Republicans have been using for 50 years, and that's exactly the narrative that Trump has tapped into in this latest election cycle.
Professor Lopez, Reagan, Romney, and Trump all have spouted similar rhetoric of a country of makers versus takers. And from your point of view, how do progressive organizations and politicians counter the conscious strategy to stoke racism and scapegoatism, where many working class, poor and white citizens end up voting against their own economic self-interest and for the very wealthiest 1% and Wall Street's agenda?
In the United States, class has been constituted through race, and race functions as a weapon to be used in class struggles. That is, class and race are inseparable. And that means that for progressives to respond, we need a unified story that we can tell to whites and to people of color, sufficient to get these groups to form a new multiracial progressive coalition. And that story has to be something like this. It's race that's been used to divide us so that we hand over power to the very rich. And until all of us commit to getting past racism, none of us can hope to restore a country in which power is wielded by the people rather than by the corporations. We need a story that combines a simultaneous emphasis on racial justice and economic justice.
Given that racial prejudice has been part of American culture for so many decades, are you optimistic that we can get to a place where we can, down the line, transcend race and bring people together, unify them on these economic issues that have for so long gone in a direction not in the interest of the majority of the American public?
This may be the first moment in the history of the country in which we can say to whites, racism is really bad for you and your children. Right. Up until now, most whites have thought about racism as something that at best is a moral issue that they need to engage with, but not as something that's really fundamental to the well-being of their children. But that's changed. That's changed. If you are a member of the white working class 50 years ago, you could say to yourself, hey, maybe racism is wrong, but it's working for me. But if you're a member of the white working class today, you need to look around and say, wow, racism has been devastating for communities of color. But it's been devastating for me, too, because it explains what happened to my job, what happened to my pension, and why my kid's future is more bleak than my own. That's truly revolutionary. For the United States to arrive at a point where everybody in the country, including whites, starts to say racism is bad for all of us, that, I think, is what's different about 2016 than about 1964. That's what I think makes it possible for us to think, you know, this is the pivot. This is the moment when the whole country turns against racism and begins what must be a decades-long effort to finally get past race as a source of division in order to build a truly progressive multiracial coalition.
That was Ian Haney Lopez, John H. Bull Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of the book, Dog Whistle Politics. Find links to Professor Lopez's recent In These Times article titled, Understanding What Makes Donald Trump Voters Tick, and related information by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. 10 days of grassroots protest actions all over the world, dubbed Break Free from Fossil Fuels May 6th through the 15th, was organized by the climate activist group 350.org. One of the first actions was held on May 7th in Philadelphia, where Phil Rinaldi, the owner of Philadelphia Energy Solutions, or PES, wants to expand a massive oil refinery into a giant energy hub. The project's goal is to build new pipelines and transport more oil into a residential area of Philadelphia, a low-income neighborhood where residents are mostly people of color. Two local groups, Action United and Philly Thrive, organize people from throughout Philadelphia, especially those living near the refinery, to participate in the protest. The rally began with a very spirited show by a local drill team. Then hundreds of people marched a few blocks, where dozens held giant cardboard sunflowers and occupied an intersection for a quarter hour to represent 25% of Philadelphia's children who suffer from asthma, to which PES contributes with its toxic pollution. The activists then marched to the gates of the refinery, where some risked arrest by blocking the entrance. Local police, however, opted not to arrest anyone, and demonstrators finished the day at a barbecue. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus participated in the event, and afterwards spoke with one of the local leaders from Action United, Maxine McCleary. Here, 74-year-old McCleary talks about why city activists and neighbors oppose the expansion of the Philadelphia refinery and the goals of the protest action.
It was a lot of asthma, kids that had asthma. Some adults had asthma. You know, my adult children got asthma. You know, asthma has always been around for a long time. People talked about that. And they always talked about the air pollution. You know, we always talk about the air pollution. Philadelphia, you can't breathe sometimes here in Philly. And we'd be wondering where all that stuff be coming from. And I never really thought about the refinery. I thought about it, that it would affect people. You know, I can't understand why they would do something that will affect people's lives and livelihood, you know? I said, like, my little boy I got here, he missed a lot of schools. I mean, he only in fourth grade now, but he has missed a lot of schools. And he always was mentioned on his report card, you know, about he do better if he come to school regularly.
And I saw a little girl holding a sign saying, give us school nurses instead of a refinery.
There's no school nurses, and the ones they have only work like 2 or 3 days a week. They go from school to school. Philadelphia's public schools have gone downhill.
Maxine McCleary, can you explain exactly what this proposed expansion would do?
They want to expand and in other words, not make their place bigger, but to, like, go underground, because they have some property there. You know, they already have it. It's not in use around them. And they want to expand, like, put more trains out, put more trucks out for the fuel. So that's what we mean by expansion, not that they're going to make the place bigger. They want to expand by getting out more fuel, more and more fuel. And there's enough coming out now. You know, so that's going to be like a 24-hour thing, which it is now. But when they say expand, they be going to be going. The trains will be leaving more often. Them trains is a section of South Philly and Southwest Philly. Those trains go right by them. And they say those trains be running all hours of the night and be making, you know, all this noise. Right. Who want all that talk? Don't know what they might be bringing in. I never saw a copy of an evacuation plan until I joined Action United, and we asked for one. Then all of a sudden, everybody got one in the mail.
Do you have confidence in the evacuation plan?
No. I mean, because trains derail, you know. I wouldn't feel safe.
And why did you decide to risk arrest?
I did it for my family. I did it for my family. I had my mother and father both died, and my three brothers, one just a year ago, and they all had some kind of respiratory cancer. And my little boy I have here now that has asthma, and they've grown. you know, and they still have asthma. And I have a respiratory problem that they diagnosed me with in 1995, sarcoidosis. And, you know, that's like a lung problem. Like they said, if I get a cold or anything, I could be seriously ill. But I've been lucky through the years so far. But anyway, that's one of the reasons I did it. I'm not saying that the refinery caused all the people asthma, but I think it contributed to it. And for them to want to put more pollution in the air, no, that's not good. They don't want us to breathe. And then in the neighborhoods, they put it. Why don't they go put it out in the desert somewhere, not around residential areas?
Do you think this rally will make a difference?
I hope it do. We'll find out when we go to the next meeting. We talked to the deputy mayor, and he don't seem to think it's going to happen, the expansion. So we don't know, but we're going to be ready. They say they'll make a decision by July. And then they told us at one meeting, the first meeting, that the PDS put in a bid, but they didn't give them a complete bid, and they were waiting for some more information from them.
That was Maxine McCleary, a leader with the Philadelphia chapter of Action United. Find more information on groups opposing expansion of the Philadelphia Energy Solutions refinery by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The March 3rd assassination of Honduran indigenous leader Berta Cáceres, winner of the prestigious 2015 Goldman Environmental Prize, triggered widespread protests in the Central American country and across the globe. Cáceres, who was murdered in her home, led her indigenous Lenca people and the Civic Council of Indigenous and Popular Organizations of Honduras, or COPIN, that actively opposed the construction of the proposed Agua Zarca Dam on the Gualcarque River, an area considered sacred by the Lenca. She had previously reported receiving numerous death threats from police, soldiers, and local landowners because of her activism. On March 15th, her colleague Nelson Garcia of Copin was also murdered. A growing number of social justice activists, environmentalists, and journalists have been killed or disappeared since the 2009 coup in Honduras. On May 2nd, the Honduran government arrested 5 men, whom they say are linked to Cáceres' murder. 2 of those charged are employed by DESA, the construction firm engaged in a land dispute with the Lenca people over 4 controversial dam projects. 1 suspect is a retired Honduran Armed Forces lieutenant and military intelligence specialist, and another was a Honduran Army Special Forces veteran. A delegation of indigenous rights activists from the U.S. traveled to Honduras May 2nd through the 4th and met with representatives of the U.S. Embassy. Among other issues, delegates asked the embassy staff to support Berta Cáceres' family and activist community demand that the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights conduct an independent investigation into Cáceres' assassination, and that all security and military aid from the U.S. government to Honduras be suspended until the massive violations of human rights in Honduras ends. Your reporter spoke with Alberto Saldamando, counsel to the Indigenous Environmental Network, who participated in the Honduran delegation. Here he recounts his meeting with U.S. officials and the concerns expressed by the Hondurans he met.
The meeting with the embassy was not all that satisfactory. I'm sure they're well meaning, good people, but, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And there is this road to hell going on now in Honduras. While we were there and visiting the family of Berta Cáceres, it was announced that they had arrested an army major, an employee and director, and another director of the DESA, the hydroelectric company that Berta was struggling against, and another friend, the trigger man, in her assassination. But many people believe, all the people we talked to believe, that her assassination goes higher and goes into the highest reaches of government and the military. And until those people are prosecuted, there's not going to be any justice for Berta Cáceres. And that's where the Kupin people were demonstrating about. That it can't stop where it is now. There's another level of intellectual authors of that crime that have to be arrested and prosecuted. And that's what they want, and that's what they're expecting. The U.S. Has been involved in the investigation. Some of the FBI people and their FBI-trained people have been conducting the investigation that led to these arrests. But Copin and the civil society organizations are demanding that there be an independent investigation conducted by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. They have credibility. They have the investigators. They've done this before. They know how to investigate. But the United States says, well, this that the governmental investigation is adequate. It's been doing the job. But really, it's a, at best, it's a problem of perceptions. But if the people perceive that this investigation is not going to reach those most responsible for her murder, whether or not it's true, it's important that the United States, at least in the interest of the United States, that they not be seen as cooking this investigation. Whether or not it's true, the perception that the United States is leading this investigation is out there. The perception is that the United States will inhibit a complete and thorough investigation of this murder.
Now that you're back from Honduras, what kind of pressure are you and members of your organization going to exert on the U.S. government to suspend U.S. military and security aid to the government of Honduras until the human rights situation is rectified there? And certainly topping that list is your advocacy and demand for an independent investigation of Berta Cáceres' murder.
So the one thing that we're doing actually is really trying to tell the story of Honduras to indigenous, other indigenous peoples and other elements of civil society that are receptive to this. In the long run, we'll be writing letters to our congressional representatives about the dire situation of human rights in Honduras and asking them to suspend this aid. In fact, the call is from the civil society organizations we visited that all aid to Honduras be stopped pending a resolution of all these human rights violations. We do plan to continue in our work in solidarity with Honduras, with the Honduran indigenous peoples and Vía Campesina and other civil society. We need the whole of civil society in the United States as well to take up the call. We need the participation of everyone, whether they're in organizations on their own, to demonstrate their solidarity with the people of Honduras and to contact their congressmen and representatives, senators, to ensure that aid, military aid and military assistance, so-called security assistance, not be given, but also that the aid that we do give doesn't go to the corrupt officials and local officials in Honduras that are really doing a gigantic land grab of indigenous lands and using these murders and these extrajudicial executions to intimidate the people, to shut them up. Because a lot of the people we spoke to were frightened. They were scared. There really is a tremendous amount of fear in Honduras on the part of social activists. It doesn't keep them from acting. But really, that is a terrible condition to be in. A lot of activists, grassroots activists, are being threatened with not only death, but also imprisonment. They're being harassed. So we need people to demonstrate their solidarity with the indigenous peoples of Honduras and Honduran civil society. What we can do is try to promote that solidarity, but I think your listeners as well might take an interest, do a little bit of work, so that all these voices are heard.
That was Alberto Saldamondo, counsel to the Indigenous Environmental Network. Learn more about the organizations working to hold Honduran government officials accountable for the massive human rights violations in the country by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Flamboyant realtor and reality TV star Donald J. Trump announced his candidacy. The political world, pundits, columnists, politicians, and the press almost choked themselves with their chortles, guffaws, and chuckles. Trump, overnight, became the butt of every joke. Slowly, thematically, one by one, he whittled down his opposition until he stood alone. Guess who's laughing now? Using ridicule, low humor, and a bully's unerring sense for the weakness of his prey, Trump decimated the field. His competitors grumbled, barked, and bellowed as they left, but they all exited. Trump's jibes hit each of them right between the ribs, leaving them fallen, gasping for air. That's because Trump, free of a politician's caution, broke all the rules and made his own. Why? Because billionaires can do that. Well, billionaires can do whatever they want. Which leads us to Trump's running mate. He's already got one. His wealth. Trump's money allowed him to run roughshod over the rules of the game, and it forced his opponents to spend like sailors on shore leave. They spent millions on ads. He spent thousands. He kept his powder dry for the general elections, even as he used free media, or should I say, corporate media, to pummel lying Ted into the ground. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has her work cut out for her as she faces an unpredictable Donald Trump. It won't be boring. The entire race has been the foolish underestimation of a man driven by ego and ambition. Those who underestimated him the most were left supine on the sidewalk. Prepare for a political street fight, because it's gonna get ugly. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Thank you. of Fannie Shakur, 1947 to 2016. She was born Alice Faye Williams in the dusty town of Lumberton, North Carolina, January 10, 1947. A dimpled little black girl who grew into a petite young revolutionary known as Fannie Shakur, mother of a young rap icon and actor, Tupac Shakur. Like many country people, and for too many black people, she looked down at herself for years as not smart enough, not pretty enough, you know, too black. When she joined the Black Panther Party in New York circa 1966, she still had a lot of those attitudes. But the black revolution, at least for a time, changed some of those views. She rarely knew the effect she had on others, for when she entered a room, one felt the urge to rise. She seemed to wonder, who were they rising for? Safia Bukhari, the late Black Panther and Black Liberation Army soldier, wrote in her book, The War Before of a Fannie, an elfin, dark-skinned woman with a very short afro. Fannie Shakur exemplified the strength and dignity amid chaos that I needed to see. She walked with the grace that Safia saw as regality. She was far more than Tupac's mom, but even he recognized her specialness as seen in his classic piece, Dear Mama. She was, in Tupac's words, a black queen. She had her demons, as do we all, drugs, poverty, homelessness. But despite her poverty of riches, she raised a bold black prince, Tupac Amaru Shakur, who in his brief life spit fire and rage and gained the ear of millions. Fannie Shakur, after 69 springs, returns to the infinite. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu Jamal. Shaka Boonam. It has been long established in America that there can be no taxation on citizens without representation. But in Pennsylvania, prisoners pay taxes but can't vote. In the Commonwealth State of Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania Department of Revenue and the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections require prisoners to pay a sales tax on consumer items of food, cigarettes, clothes, and phone cards purchased from the prison's commissary. According to the Pennsylvania Department of Revenue, if the purchase price is more than $10, 6% state sales tax and or 1% local sales tax of each dollar, plus charges listed in its brackets of charges, upon any fractional part of a dollar must be collected from inmates. Despite incarcerated citizens being required to pay state and local sales taxes, Pennsylvania law, Title 25, Sections 2602 and 2811 does not consider prisoners as qualified electors or qualified absentee voters and effectively deny incarcerated citizens the right to vote in elections. Hence, Pennsylvania incarcerated citizens are being subjected to taxation without representation. In America, a major component of a democratic government is universal suffrage, that is, the right for all citizens to vote. On last account, America's prisoners are still citizens in the truest sense of the word. And as incarcerated citizens, their federal constitutional right to vote in the country's elections and not be discriminated against shall not be infringed upon, denied, or abridged.
America is a nation that prides itself at being the best democratic government in the world. But such grandiose pronouncements are hypocrisy and mass deception at its best, because there can be no democracy in America where incarcerated citizens are denied their right to vote in elections and are disenfranchised due to imprisonment. Where is the American Civil Liberties Union when we really need them? From the belly of the beast at Prison Radio, I am Shaka Buna. Thank you for listening.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
how were the good, well-meaning people of Canada convinced to aid and abet the detention of thousands of Eastern Europeans, genocidal policies towards Indigenous people, and the carrying out of imperialist violence in Africa, Haiti, and elsewhere? Could J.S. Woodsworth and other left icons have been defenders of empire? What role did the social gospel and elite institutions like Wesley College have in subverting the historic Winnipeg General Strike? Are manipulative narratives of Canadian exceptionalism repeating themselves today? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we discuss the mythologies that persist in Canada historically and that continue to hold its residents captive and willing agents of oppression in service of the country's elites. We spend the hour speaking with longtime anti-war activist Richard Saunders on the occasion of the release of the latest issue of Press for Conversion. On this week's program, Canada Syndrome, Good People Supporting Mass Internment, War and Genocide, a conversation with Richard Saunders. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 13th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The CIA institutionalized the term conspiracy theory in its very successful attempt to derail the honest attempts to investigate the roles of various governmental agencies and individuals that were involved in the execution of President Kennedy in 1963. Of course, all clandestine state-sponsored secret service agencies like the CIA, MI6, and Mossad routinely and shamelessly make use of lies, secrecy, deception, and false flag operations in their daily affairs. It is a fact of life for such secret agencies, and it is all accomplished in the name of, quote-unquote, national security. Secret intelligence agencies such as the CIA routinely concoct conspiracies that involve spying, regime changes, destabilization of governments, expansion of military bases, and even torture, disappearances, suicides, quote-unquote, and extrajudicial assassinations as a matter of course. Of course, all leaked evidence of what are often unethical, immoral, or even criminal deeds must be denied. That comes from the article, Weaponizing the Term Conspiracy Theory, Disinformation Agents and the CIA, by Dr. Gary G. Coles, posted May 11th. If the EU were to collapse today, both the TTIP and the TISA talks would come to a standstill. Any one of the 28 EU countries, or better even, of the 19 Eurozone countries, could bring the EU down. A Brexit, a fiasco emerging from the forthcoming rehash of the Spanish elections, or a firm decision by a government to default on its mostly troika-imposed debt could bring the house of cards of the dollar pyramid scheme to fall and erase once and for all the enslaving dollar-euro hegemony. Imagine what a collapse of the EU and the Eurozone would mean for the Greek people, though rumors have it that more than half the Greek are still adamant in hanging on to the destructive euro. I bet its collapse would have hundreds of thousands dancing in the streets. That comes from the article, The Collapse of the European Union, Return to National Sovereignty and to Happy Europeans, by Peter Koenig, posted May 11th. For years now, we have admired Roger Waters' moral courage, his refusal to back down from his criticism of Israel, even if his career is torched by his witness. And I have heard rumors of that career blackmail being levied at the legendary musician who never met his father or grandfather because they died freeing Europe, and who burst into rock and roll fame without even wanting that when he was in his early 20s because he was political before he was musical. Those rumors are confirmed. Now, this committed soul has burst out in the English press with a description of the vicious smears the Israel lobby has used against him, which he has overcome in an effort to gather others to join him in speaking out against Israeli apartheid. Pointing out that British musicians have supported BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions campaign, Waters says that American artists are scared shitless against such actions because their careers, quote, will be destroyed, unquote. But we need them desperately, as we did in Vietnam days. That comes from the article, American musicians are scared their careers will be destroyed if they speak up for Palestinians, says Roger Waters, by Philip Weiss, posted May 11th, originally appearing at Mondo Weiss. On Tuesday, in an open military provocation, the Obama administration authorized the U.S. Navy to send a guided missile destroyer into the 12 nautical mile territorial zone surrounding Chinese-held Fiery Cross Reef, located in the Spratly Island chain in the South China Sea. The operation was carried out on the fraudulent pretext of, quote-unquote, freedom of navigation. That is, the assertion by U.S. imperialism that it has the right to send its military forces anywhere it chooses at any time in Chinese-claimed waters. The U.S. Navy carried out a freedom of navigation mission that last October in Chinese-claimed waters around Subi Reef in the South China Sea and a second operation in January near Triton Island in the Paracel Island chain. On those occasions, China did not react militarily but issued strongly worded diplomatic protests. The response to the intrusion near Fiery Cross Reef indicates that from this point on, U.S. provocations will be engaged by Chinese forces, posing the danger of a military clash. That comes from the article, War Danger Grows Following New U.S. Provocation in South China Sea, by James Cogan, posted May 11th, originally appearing at World Socialist website. In 2014, the Sino-Iranian trade volume totaled $52 billion U.S. compared to a Russian-Iranian trade volume of only $1.6 billion U.S. and $10 billion between Iran and the entire EU-28. During nuclear sanctions, China was Iran's most significant foreign trade partner, exporting capital goods and engineering services and investing in infrastructure projects. With nuclear sanctions now lifted, China seems to be aware that whatever the obstacles for European firms, it might face increased competition. Losing no time, the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, paid a visit to Iran in January, signing a Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership and announcing 17 agreements in the energy, trade, and industrial sectors. Iran is important to China's One Belt, One Road initiative that would join markets from China to Central Asia and the Middle East. That comes from the article, Iran, Europe Eyes a New Silk Road and Squares Up to Russia and China, by Moritz Piper, posted May 11th, originally appearing at NSNBC. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. A number of myths pervade the history of social reform in Canada. Canadians of all ideologies typically embrace the commonly held narrative of Canada as the peaceable kingdom, or Canada as the nation of peacekeepers and such. The reality, however, is far less than benign. Moreover, these narratives have served to help mobilize support for state violence directed both internally and abroad, or so argues our next guest. His name is Richard Saunders. He is the organizer with the Coalition Opposed to the Arms Trade and the lead writer, researcher, and editor of the long-running magazine Press for Conversion. The latest issue is called Captive Canada, Renditions of the Peaceable Kingdom at War from Narratives of World War I and the Red Scare to the Mass Internment of Civilians. Welcome, Richard Saunders.
Yeah, thanks very much.
So, Richard Saunders, may I ask, it's been a while since you've put out a copy of Press for Conversion. I mean, how long have you been researching this particular issue of the magazine and this subject you call Canada Syndrome?
Well, the last few years, but it's sort of been a culmination of my work in the peace movement I've been busying myself in the peace movement for about 30 years. So it's sort of a culmination of all those years of research but in particular, the stuff about World War I and the concentration camps and the forced labor camps and that's dealt with in this particular issue, I guess the last year or so has been the main focus of my efforts.
I was wondering if there's a specific example of something that just stood out about the way the anti-war movement, such as it is, or the peace movement is conducting itself that may have led you to go down this sort of psychological path.
Well, I guess I've been thinking along these lines pretty much since I first got involved in the 1980s. At that time, I was involved in organizing nonviolent direct actions, like civil disobedience, through an organization that doesn't exist anymore. It's the Alliance for Nonviolent Action. And we organized big sit-down protests. And there was talk in those days about kind of a rift within the movement between those who would be more radical in terms of not just their actions of being willing to risk arrest and sit down and block the gates of a weapons bazaar, for example, something we did in 1989 when I was involved in when I started COAT, Coalition Opposed to the Arms Trade. So over the years, I've had the, I guess, freedom to research and study and try to understand things that I felt that the mainstream peace movement wasn't looking at. So I've always tried to, okay, well, what is the mainstream peace movement missing here? What are they leaving out of the narrative? So, for example, in 2004, when Canada, the U.S., and France invaded and occupied Haiti and overthrew the government there, and other Canadians, more radical peace activists, human rights activist types, we focused on how Canadian mainstream peace, human rights, and development organizations were supporting that coup and the dictatorship that was installed in Haiti, and how they were funded by CETA. And so, again, it's this split between more radical activists who are working on peace, development, human rights issues, and the more mainstream, and often those non-governmental organizations are funded by the government, but they're not always funded by the government. And so what is it? Why is it that these organizations support something that to the radicals like myself seems so obvious? This is, you know, we're supporting the U.S. military. It's not just that they're funded by the government, because not all of them are. Some of these groups aren't funded by the government. So what is it? Well, it has to do with narratives, and this is something that's become much, much more clear to me over the last year. Good, honest, decent, well-meaning people in these different progressive movements can become captivated by these narratives, which lead them to believe that what they're doing is actually a good thing, but really they're doing more harm than good, because they're going along with a government-sponsored program. It could be genocide. Like with the residential schools,
The way you put it in the magazine, the way you put it in the magazine, you do invoke a quote from Samuel Taylor Coleridge, of the willing suspension of disbelief as a tool for instilling faith and embracing an imaginary world. And then you posit the question, what happens when you suspend disbelief on a long-term basis in a state narrative?
Right.
And so I suppose that's what we're seeing right now. And this is something that just – you're not just talking about war, but going back – you know, over a century with the whole business of the occupy, like how was it we were able to support basically genocidal policies against the indigenous peoples as well as the mass internments and so on and so forth.
Right. Yeah. As a kid in high school, I was inspired by Coleridge and his romantic poetry, and the way it was 200 years ago, this year, 1817, that he came up with this expression that everybody knows now, willing suspension of disbelief. So he used it to talk about how people set aside their disbelief in an obvious falsehood so that they can enjoy some cultural or artistic expression like poetry or we could think of it or watching a movie, although they didn't have movies then. But nowadays, often people think of it with a movie. Well, you know, it was a science fiction movie and there were aliens and whatever. But I set that aside. And I didn't question that. I just wanted to enjoy the movie. And so that meant that I had to willingly suspend my disbelief in all these false things that were going on in the movie, like aliens or whatever. Well, the same thing happens when people go along with and they suspend their disbelief in a general cultural narrative. For example, Aboriginals are inferior, blacks are inferior, Christians are inferior, non-Christians. So there's this feeling of superiority or whatever, which, you know, part of you might think, well, I don't know about that. Is that true? Are we really superior or not? But you're willing to suspend it and go along with the official narrative. So I think that a lot of the people who were the most involved in these crimes, in genocidal crimes, like the residential schools, like forcing people to be on reservations, and so that they couldn't live their culture, their religion, their trade, etc. So it's another way of destroying an enemy culture. So people who believe those official narratives about others, the xenophobic, racist, ethnocentric narratives, they actually, I think most of them who were administering and running these programs, actually really believed it. So they're not. And they are the best people to spread these false narratives. The best people to spread a false narrative are not kind of lying right-wing corporate elite, some little clique of, you know, really nasty types who are trying to deceive us. It's not them, because you can see through their what they're saying more easily, because if they're lying, it's easier to see they're lying. But if somebody actually believes what they're saying, then it's harder to perceive that it's a lie or that it isn't a lie, really, because they really believe it. Mm. So
this idea then, I mean, that all of these narratives do serve a function of allowing for a certain Eurocentric domination of the land at the expense
right.
of indigenous peoples and
land
a certain
plunder.
And but also to block the influence of newcomers from Eastern Europe with different political ideologies. And so this is all – I mean it seems so convenient in a sense that people – if you are correct, people actually believe these things and it just happens to play into this, you know, the
– Yeah, it's not a coincidence that it plays into the imperial agenda, you know, for power and control over wealth and resources. It's not a coincidence. I believe there are people who know – that the narratives are a lie. I'm not saying that there aren't people that know that it's a lie. I'm just saying that so often, well, first thing, it's really hard to know who really realizes it's a lie and who has just been suckered in by it and really believes it. I think the majority of people that are going along with and accepting, sort of standing by, folded arms and watching these horrible things in the world happening, as well as most of the people who are actually carrying out these programs of genocide, up to and including genocide, actually believe it. But do they? It's very difficult troubling problem, you know, because at some level, do they not realize? Do they not understand that they're complicit in something despicable or something that feeds that corporate agenda? You know.
I wonder if you could just give us a couple of examples. For example, there was the renditions of Eastern Europeans around the time of the war. What was in place that allowed the wider public to just embrace this as? Not only acceptable but necessary.
Yeah, we've been talking in very general terms, and you really do need to get some specific examples to make sense of these sort of general themes or principles or theories that we've been talking about. Okay, so leading up to the Second World War in Canada, or sorry, not the Second World War, the First World War. So in the early part of the 1900s, probably the most powerful progressive movement at that time was called the Social Gospel, and its leaders were religious. They were largely Methodists. J.S. Woodsworth is still well known to many progressive Canadians, and he was the first leader, and he was very instrumental in founding the CCF, which became the NDP in 1961. So anyway, back in before World War One. The Social Gospel had completely, which was the most progressive wing within the churches. So these are progressive, good, well-meaning people who were trying to help others, trying to uplift others who they saw as less less well-off than themselves, and in many ways they saw them as inferiors. So they were trying to help by doing education, by civilizing, Christianizing, educating those who were from lower classes or inferior races. This is the way that they looked at it, okay? And these were progressive people, like J.S. Woodsworth. They embraced the residential schools. They thought it was a good thing because they were helping these poor savages, these heathens, these uncivilized, unchristian people, and they needed to teach them. They needed to destroy Aboriginal cultures in order to civilize and Christianize and Canadianize. They talked about Canadianizing. Okay, so it wasn't just the Aboriginals that they thought were inferior. J.S. Woodsworth wrote a book in, I think it was 1908 or was it 1909? I can't remember now. I have it in my hand. I won't look up the date on it. But in that, it's called Strangers Within Our Gates, Coming Canadians, and he kind of, each chapter looks at a different ethnic group, and he basically labels every cultural, racial group in the world as inferior to Anglo-Saxons, and he wasn't even happy about all Anglo-Saxons, because he was a classist as well as being a racist and a xenophobe. So he wasn't too crazy about having a lot of very poor white people coming to Canada from England or Germany, although they had the advantage in his mind that they could be enculturated or assimilated to become Canadians, whereas, you know, Asians, people from the Middle East, Africans, Aboriginals, it's really hard to assimilate them, according to the people like J.S. Woodsworth and the Social Gospel at the time. So, but one of the main groups that they really despised were people from Eastern Europe, particularly ones who were more radicalized, and they were atheists. So if you've got a socialist, atheist, Eastern European who's just fled to Canada to escape there's a huge political turmoil in Russia, in the Russian Empire at the time. In 1905, the Tsarist troops had killed 1,000 or more people in a Bloody Sunday event. It was called Bloody Sunday, and they shot down and killed about 1,000 or more peaceful protesters. And there was a huge, almost successful revolution that happened in 1905 to 1907 in the Russian Empire. I didn't know that much about it, but I learned a lot more about it during my research. And it's fascinating history. So there were huge general strikes and huge protests of hundreds of thousands of people in all these cities all across Eastern Europe. And it didn't succeed, but 10 years later, they did have a successful revolution, and successful in the sense of, getting rid of the Tsar and replacing it with a different system. So it was a revolution that came to fruition, whereas the one in 1905 to 1907, the Tsar remained in power. But a lot of these refugees came to Canada. So the social gospelers, who were very Christian, didn't like them because they were atheists, didn't like them because they were radical revolutionary types, or not all of them were, but some of them were. And the social gospelers and J.S. Wordsworth were most fearful of these Eastern Europeans because they thought they had the greatest potential for becoming radicalized and revolutionary within Canada. So they were quite fearful of a revolution in Canada. In fact, there were fears amongst the imperial elites, European elites, who had colonies all over the world. There was a series of revolts and rebellions and anti-monarchist and anti-imperialist struggles and revolutions that were going on all over the world in all of these different colonies of all of the European powers. So they were really worried, and they were even worried about revolutionaries in Canada. And so I think, and the research that I've done tries to show a different narrative from what we usually hear about when we read about the concentration camps that Eastern Europeans, mostly Ukrainians, were put in Canada. There were about 8,000, mostly Ukrainians, who were put into these forced labor camps, these slave labor camps in Canada. And I think that a big part of the reason why they were targeted was because of the fear that they were going to become radicalized and become revolutionary and cause all sorts of troubles, stir up strikes and things like that in Canada. And so the excuse that was the war, World War One, was used as a pretext or an excuse to round up thousands of these East European immigrants and put them into concentration camps. So it's a different narrative from what exists now as the official narrative. The Canadian government and its allies in the right wing, a nationalist Ukrainian community in Canada, and the Ukrainians in Canada are really split between right and left, even to this day, and they were 100 years ago as well.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Could you talk about the effect of the social gospel on perpetuating the genocide of Indigenous peoples?
So, the social gospel, as I said, was, trying to basically eradicate Aboriginal cultures. And maintain the power of the Christian elites in Canada, the Anglo-Protestant elites. The establishment was all the major institutions within the state were Christian, And so it just seemed natural to them, to their way of thinking, that Aboriginal people had to be subjugated, they had to be assimilated. And so they put these residential school programs in power, in effect. And the social gospel movement, the role that it played was, in short, to create narratives that the general public, being good, honest people — I think people are generally good, honest, well-meaning, they don't like to do harm, or not. Society isn't made out of psychopaths. People like to think that they're doing the right thing. So the role of these this progressive movement, the social gospel, and its leaders like J.S. Whitsworth, was to create narratives that could be used by the general public to get them to not only go along with and sort of stand by and let these horrible cultural genocidal things happen, but to actually take a role in making them happen and contributing their taxes to make them happen and administering the programs.
Well, that's it's interesting, but it still, it kind of makes you wonder, like, the level of sophistication that would be involved, like a kind of form of a psychological warfare, where xenophobia and good intentions mix in with colonial and imperialist ambitions. And I don't know if you wanted to address if you could talk about masterminds, if you will, who might be directing these things as a kind of military intelligence operation or other?
One person that comes to mind is William Randolph Hearst. Now, he's not a Canadian. This is in the American context, but it's the same thing would apply in Canada with our own equivalents. But maybe people have heard of William Randolph Hearst. He was a corporate tycoon. He was a Democratic congressman in New York. He was the father of so-called yellow journalism. He owned big newspapers, and they had yellow dye in some of their cartoons, and the yellow spread through the paper, and so it was called yellow journalism. So he was the hegemon of a newspaper empire, and of course he fabricated huge webs of deceit and deception to trick people into supporting wars like the Spanish-American War in 1898. So the Hearst family story, like of this powerful newspaper magnate, you know, having such a huge impact through the mainstream media on people's attitudes, this is kind of, I think, what you're talking about. You've got a key individual who has a lot of power in influencing masses of people. So his granddaughter was Patty Hearst. She was kidnapped in 1973 or 74. And she was kidnapped by this radical revolutionary group, which is very spooky group. It was the Symbionese Liberation Army. If people Google it, they can find all sorts of weird stuff about this organization. It had ties to the CIA, and it was a very odd group. At least some of its leaders were linked to the CIA and the FBI. Anyway, that aside, she was kidnapped, and she ended up going along, getting brainwashed, and going along with other bank robberies, kidnappings, I think even a bombing, and all sorts of major crimes. She only spent 2 years in jail. The reason she only spent 2 years in jail, and the reason she was later pardoned by Carter and Clinton, they both sort of exonerated her, what she had done, was because of this thing called the Stockholm Syndrome. There was a bank heist in Sweden in 73, just before she was kidnapped. And the police psychologist came up with this idea that kidnapped people could be kind of brainwashed into supporting the beliefs and ideologies of their captors. It's an interesting phenomenon that people have probably heard of, the Stockholm Syndrome. So it's interesting, I think, that Patty Hearst was seen as a victim of the Stockholm Syndrome, because she went along with her captors and she was brainwashed, and this helped to get her off for doing the crimes that she did. But what about her grandfather? He could capture masses of people. He could kidnap their minds and control their thoughts. Not control, that's a strong word, but I mean he could have a powerful influence over the people that he's sort of holding under his sway through the control of a narrative, through the different narratives that are spread by the newspapers. So, but of course, he never went to jail. He never was, convicted as a criminal for his role in, you could say, metaphorically kidnapping people, captivating, because captivation is really a central trope here, a central metaphor of what I've been doing, of my research, captivation, mass civilian captivation. So people can be captivated and held captive behind bars or behind barbed wire like they were in these concentration camps in World War I and between the wars and during World War II, and like the plans that they had all through the Cold War called the Profunk to round up communists and other radicals in Canada. For 30, 40 years we had this, the RCMP was planning to round up several thousand people per year. But so you can hold people in behind bars, in jail and whatnot, but you can also captivate people's hearts and minds and control their ideologies through the use of narratives. So if you can control people or captivate them, capture them using narratives, it's a much more effective way to control masses of people. Like, it's difficult to put thousands and thousands of people behind barbed wire. They did it in World War I with these forced labor concentration camps. But it's much more effective if you can capture people, control them through narratives.
Yeah, so basically what you're saying is that those of us who accept these narratives on the left, quote-unquote, about responsibility to protect or trying to civilize the indigenous peoples or protect us from dangerous aliens and thereby allowing them to be interned, that all of us in that regard are like Patty Hearst, that we are being subjected to this psychosis that prevents us from seeing the violence that we're doing and brings us closer to the elites who are orchestrating this mess.
Yeah, I mean, what better way, what more powerful way is there in the world to control people than through their culture, through their ideology, through the beliefs that they adopt through being a part of a culture or a nation or an ethnic identity or some kind of systematized ideological structure that holds people's in place. They hold people captive, really. What better way to do it? And the family institution, the institution of the family is a very powerful one. So for another fascinating thing I thought, it fascinated me anyway, and I think other people might be interested in, is J.S. Whitworth, his family, his background. Like, where did he get these ideas from? So I looked into his father and his paternal grandfather. I also looked into his mother's ancestors, and they were all imperialists, classists. You know, they were all part of within their society of their times, they were actually playing key roles in subverting or repressing rebellions and radicals. So, for example, his father, who was head of all missionary work in the four Western provinces,
So his father, James Woodsworth, so that's James Sr., was in charge of all the missionaries for the Methodist Church. And he was, in his autobiography, which was written in 1917, and which his son, J.S. Woodsworth Jr., helped him to edit, in that autobiography, he's very proud of his role in, and the Methodist Church's role in, subverting these heathens and savages and half-breeds, these are terms that he used, who rose up in the Northwest Rebellion trying to struggle against the land plunder and the reservations that were being a system that was being imposed on them, and the residential schools and the destruction of their culture and their economy and their religion and their ability to move freely around in the landscape. But J.S. Woodsworth's father was very proud of his role in subjugating these radicals who rose up to try to rebel. And his father, going back another generation, so J.S. Woodsworth's grandfather, was involved in opposing the radicals during the Upper Canada Rebellion in York. He was a prominent Methodist, had come from England, sided, he was a British Empire loyalist, sided with the Family Compact, which was this corrupt corporate government elite that basically controlled the legal system and corporations and government. So he was actually given a sword to fight against the rebels, and that sword was passed down generation to generation, and it hung on the wall of J.S. Woodsworth's family home in Winnipeg. Proudly hung on the wall, this sword that was used to fight against the Upper Canada rebels. And J.S. Woodsworth's son, Charles, who was the editor of the Ottawa Citizen for a time, and then became a Canadian diplomat under the Liberals, went to Vietnam and during the Vietnam War, and was complicit in helping the Americans to carry out covert military operations. He was advising them on how to do so, and secret documents that have been released show that Charles Woodsworth, J.S. Woodsworth's son, was involved in the Canadian government complicity in helping the Americans to wage the Vietnam War against revolutionary rebels there, the Viet Cong.
All in the family.
All in the family. So it just gets passed. So the family is very powerful. And this pops up again and again and again in the magazine of, family ties and family traditions. And that this is often how these narratives get passed down, is from one generation to the next. It's not just passed down through newspapers or through preaching in the pulpits, okay. These are powerful tools of propaganda for spreading narratives, for sure. But the family is also a very powerful institution within culture for passing narratives down from one generation to the next.
Richard, I want to just to, because this is a, we're based here in Winnipeg, in fact, the University of Winnipeg, which includes Wesley Hall. I wanted to know if you might be willing to, and of course, it's being recorded about 2 days before the start of the anniversary of the famous Winnipeg General Strike. I wanted to see if you could just maybe bring in some important anecdotes with regard to the social gospel as it was practiced here in Winnipeg and how it may have affected the way the general strike played out.
Okay, so are your listeners familiar with the basics of what happened during the strike, or should we talk about that, or you're more interested in the social gospel, connection to the strike?
Yeah, principally. I mean, maybe just like a really brief rundown of the dynamics leading up to it, but I wanted to get into the what was happening in terms of like who was resisting behind the scenes and
Okay, people probably already know that it was a huge strike. There was the leaders of it were arrested in late night raids, and it was against the law to rally in support of the leaders who were rounded up. But 30,000 supporters came out, and the Mounties got an order to fire into the crowd, and they killed a couple of people, and they charged in on horseback, and they injured dozens of people. Protesters were beaten with bats and wagon spokes, and they were wielded by these special police. And about 100 Reds were arrested, and then the city was occupied with military trucks mounted with machine guns, and the strike was called off, and there were a lot of radical labor activists that were fired and blacklisted, and the media blamed it all on, radical revolutionary foreigners, and then they did raids all across the country, and hundreds of radicals were rounded up and arrested, and a lot of these people were sent to a concentration camp in Kapuskasing, which is in northern Ontario. So it was a concentration camp that was still open from World War I. Even though World War I was over, some of the camps were kept in operation, and thousands of radicals were kept in these supposedly World War I concentration camps. So the camps didn't close until 1920. Anyway, this was part of a strategy to scare not only to control and kick radicals out of the country and put them behind, in cages in these concentration camps, but it was a way of scaring off anybody else from becoming active. Can you imagine if the government was rounding up activists now and throwing them into concentration camps? People would be scared to become in any way involved with radicals. You could be arrested for having a radical newspaper or wearing a button or anything like that. You know, so it would just kind of very, it's a very draconian way of controlling a society and a population just by scaring them. Now, when you think about stuff like that, you think about how it's the police and these scary elites in government that are doing it. But the progressive, so-called progressives, and they were the progressives of the day, were also had their role to play in this. So Wesley College, as I guess you call it Wesley Hall now, it's part of the University of Winnipeg, but at the time it was a Methodist university. It was a college, a Methodist college, and it was the central, most powerful educational institution in Canada for promoting the social gospel. And J.S. Woodsworth went to that college, and he graduated with flying colors. He was the student president when he graduated. And the leader of, or the long-time founding president of the college was Joseph Sparling, another Methodist minister, and he wrote the introduction to the book that I mentioned earlier that J.S. Woodsworth wrote called Strangers Within Our Gates. And oddly enough, he included Aboriginal people as strangers within our gates. This was a book about immigrants who'd come to Canada, and he had a chapter on Aboriginals, which is wrong in so many ways. Anyway, so Sparling, who was the president of the Wesley College from 1888 until his death in 1912, said in his introduction to Strangers Within Our Gates, "There is a danger, and it is national. Either we must educate and elevate the incoming multitudes, or they will drag us and our children down to their level." And he also said, "We must see to it that the civilization and ideals of Southeastern Europe are not transplanted to and perpetuated on our virgin soil." So he, like Wordsworth, and like Wordsworth's father, James, the missionary leader of Western and Northern Canada, were very fearful about Eastern Europeans. And they were arguing that the church needed to play a much more important role in opposing these scary radicals and atheists that were amongst the newcomers that were coming to Canada. And they had a very fear-mongering kind of a narrative of doom and gloom about, how Canadians needed to really pay attention to this immigrant problem. And they were spreading using statistics to show how immigrants that are coming are more prone to crime and violence and that sort of thing, without any consideration for any... they blamed it all on kind of a eugenic... They had a kind of a eugenicist view of things. You know, everything was genetically determined. You know, their racism was a very powerful thing, and often people, when you talk about these things, about J.S. Wordsworth and how he was a racist and a xenophobe and Sparling the same and the other social gospelers, I've encountered this many times, and you also read about it, but I've heard people say this to me, they say, well, you know, you can't really judge people of the past based on our knowledge that we have today. It's called presentism, this idea that, you know, we in the present have this, we're sort of privileged with this new knowledge that in the past they didn't have. And so we can't really blame them or hold them responsible or think in any way that they're guilty of any kind of wrongdoing for having gone along with genocide or for having gone along with and not opposed concentration camps. Or forced labor camps or discrimination against people based on their race or their politics or their economics. You can't criticize those people in the past because, you know, that's just the way people thought back then. That's just,
they were people of their time, and that sort of like lets them off the hook. Yeah. That kind of brings me to the last point, because we got to wrap this up pretty quick. But
yeah.
This idea of the we've got a kind of a truth and reconciliation process happening right now. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about what that might mean in this context.
Yeah. Well, we really do need to come to grips with this history of ours in the progressive left movement, the NDP, which arose from the CCF, which arose from the social gospel, which had as its leaders people like J.S. Wordsworth, who were racist, xenophobic, imperialists, and classists. We have to come to grips with that history of ours. And if we can't, then how can we ever, come to grips with much more recent problems within the NDP, like supporting the NATO war against Libya, or supporting the rise of fascism in the Ukraine, or supporting the state of Israel, right or wrong, no matter what it does, we have to be supporting the Israeli government policies towards Palestinians and Israeli apartheid. So if we can't deal with those problems of the past, like reconciling and dealing with the truth of the fact about J.S. Wordsworth and the social gospel and the roots of this movement that we belong to in Canada. If we can't deal with that, its role in residential schools, its role in other problems through history, Christianizing and Canadianizing and sort of white supremacist roots of our progressive movement, how can we ever deal with these other much more recent and current problems of complicity with state power that's still going on within the NDP? We have to realize that even back then, there were radicals that didn't agree with the CCF, that didn't agree with the social gospel. There were opponents of that. You know, they were rounded up and put in concentration camps. They were rounded up and put into residential schools. Aboriginal people knew that they weren't inferior. You know, blacks knew that they weren't inferior. Jews knew that they weren't inferior to Christians. And it goes on and on and on. It's not that everybody believed it at the time. That's BS. There were people at the time who knew that it was wrong to practice genocide. Just like there are now people, radicals today, who know that what the mainstream progressive peace, human rights, development groups are doing in their complicity with imperialism, and this happens, like you mentioned, with responsibility to protect, and there's going along with the UN's arms trade treaty, which only deals with the illicit trade in weapons, and there's going along with NATO wars here and there, because we buy into the narratives that we're doing these wars, fighting these wars, because we have to protect innocent lives and their humanitarian operations, that sort of thing. There are radicals now who know full well that these narratives are false. And there's a war of narratives that's going on between radicals and mainstream activists. And this, I think, is a really important part of our struggle, is not to just oppose these people that we see as the Harpers of the world, the right, or the Trudeaus of the world, you know, the power elites or the corporate elites. Our job isn't just to oppose them. Our job is to raise awareness of the people in our own movements who are being co-opted into believing the narratives which function to support imperial programs that are going on in the world. So we have to, it's not an, and in some ways it's a more difficult struggle.
Okay, Richard, I'm afraid I have to leave it there.
Okay.
But I want to thank you very much for sharing this with us. Richard Saunders, organizer with the Coalition Opposed to the Arms Trade and the latest issue of Press for Conversion, which is on the topic we've been discussing today, Captive Canada. For more on today's topic, the Coalition Opposed to the Arms Trade, and how you can obtain a copy of Press for Conversion magazine, please visit the website coat.ncf.ca. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.